Well, that was fast. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome to the Wednesday night version of Convention Coverage 2008. Let's go right back to the live feed for the nominating process. I don't want to miss that. And we'll crank things up here in just a couple of minutes.
2.5 votes for Hillary Clinton, and we are proud to cast 8.5 votes for the next president of the United States, Barack Obama. Thank you, Democrats abroad. Thank you, Democrats watching us all over the world.
All right, we're going to transition our feed. Mark Levine is in the Horn studio at the convention now, and Guy James is headed off to dinner and parts elsewhere. He's put in a hard broadcast day, and he did a dandy good job, and I know you appreciate it. Make sure and drop him an email and let him know how much. Let's see, what would we say here? It is Wednesday night. And being Wednesday night, you know, that's not just any ordinary night here on the program. No, Wednesday night is, in fact, prayer meeting on Head On with Bob Kincaid, you know, little old me, Brother Bob, the Bishop of the Cathedral of Common Sense. And if I was to have my druthers, what would I say? And if I was the praying type, what would I be praying for this evening, this prayer meeting Wednesday? I think I know. I think I would be praying for a miraculous healing, brethren and sistren. I would be praying for the healing hands of faith to be laid upon the Democrats, progressives, and liberals all across this great nation, so that the demonic spirit of possession that has laid upon so many of them might be miraculously healed. And our political attention deficit disorder might be cured. Hallelujah, amen, and amen. Yeah, that's a prayer worth praying for. A prayer that maybe finally, yea, verily, and forsooth, lo and behold, some of us can finally figure out that there are two choices on the ballot in November. Two on the ballot, just like a Certs commercial. There is Barack Obama and John McCain. Now, for those of you who want to see America do better, there's only one choice. There's only one choice. The third party business. Well, sorry, you might not like it, but this is not the year for the third party business. It is time to get behind. I know. He's not ideologically pure. I know. Lord God, I know. But he beats the living daylights out of old 894. Are you there, Mark Levine? Okay, we'll wait and see. Let's take some of the feed here.
Thank you, Florida. And we're so happy you're here. Florida cast 166 votes for Senator Barack Obama and 51 votes for Senator Clinton. Georgia, the state where I was born. Georgia, you have 102 votes. How do you cast them?
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow Democrats and friends, we bring you greetings from the great state of Georgia, the 13th state in our union, birthplace of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., home today of of those who carry on his great and enduring legacy, leaders like the Reverend Dr. Joseph Lowry and Congressman John Lewis.
Well, I was expecting that. That must have been the transition that we're waiting on from Mark. They're changing out mixing boards and computers and wires and all the things that go into making this little itsy bitsy miracle happen. Hey, do me a favor. I very seldom ask you guys to do this, but for those of you who are regular posters over at Democratic Underground, do me a favor, if you don't mind, please. For the past 3 days, I've been posting alerts and general discussion over there about the fact that our coverage was going on, and I've got that thread up again in general discussion. Live convention coverage on the Horn Day 3. The author is GRPCAPT Mandrake, Group Captain Mandrake. That would be me. That's my nom de guerre, all right, my pseudonym for Democratic Underground purposes. Go in and kick and recommend that thing so it'll stay up and folks can know that they can have independent media coverage live of the proceedings in Denver without having to give their statistical weight or even their money to major corporate media outlets that hate their guts. Could you do that, please? And again, I don't ask anybody to do that very often, but in this case, it is... I think it's worth doing. And I don't do that because I think I've written a particularly brilliant or gorgeous or soul-stirring post. It's not. It's just informational. But it would really help if we could keep that thing kicked and up on top of the general discussion list so that folks can know what we're doing and how we're doing it. I just said... join us on the Horn for truly independent coverage of the Democratic National Convention. No Buy Gold Now ads, no ads for herbal baldness cures or vacuum cleaners that pick up Swedish mattresses pioneered by NASA. Just conversation centered on our live on-scene coverage from Denver. Independent media's future is now, and it's on the Horn, America's liberal voice. That's all I did. So if you would kick it and recommend it, I would sincerely appreciate it. It would mean a lot. Because this isn't my ego. This isn't Guy's ego. This isn't Mark's ego. This is genuinely about what we are attempting to do here at the Horn. And that is to show a different way of presenting all of this. And I'm waiting patiently right now for Mark Levine to reconnect and hoping that we haven't somehow missed the over-the-top vote that will make Obama the nominee. In the meantime, well, I went and checked on it. I know. But that, why do you think I prayed the prayer I prayed earlier about having our political attention deficit disorder miraculously healed by the healing hands of laying on of faith and stuff and tongue speaking and so forth? I couldn't help following up just to see what others were saying about Senator Clinton's speech last night. If you've spent any time at all with this program, you know that I did not vote for Senator Clinton. You know that others on this network did. But you know that I do believe, I know. Believing is for sissies and suckers. I know that nothing good is going to come of liberals and progressives pissing away their votes on third-party candidates. You might not like it, but it's true. Because you can't elect Cynthia McKinney, and you can't elect Ralph or anybody like that. Now, I'm politically mature and cynical enough to hope that there's all kinds of pissed-off right-wingers and conservatives and rock-ribbed Republicans out there who will vote for Bob Barr. Gosh, I really want him to do that specifically because it is deleterious to old 894's campaign. Bless her heart, she stands for so many good things, and the issues that Ralph Nader has championed have been good issues. But damn, can't we please get something approaching a semblance of power first? Or do we just have to unload the banana clip into our feet? Blam, 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 blam. You see, because, you know, well, let's see. I went over to Huffington Post earlier today, and lo and behold, there was a post by Nora Ephron just, you know, talking nasty smack about Hillary's speech last night. Damn, let go of it. Let go of it. We're going to have a nominee, and we're trying to bring the party together, and people spitting back and forth at each other ain't helping. You know what I mean? Stand by. I've got a tech again. Then you're doing something wrong. Let's see if we're getting anything from Mark. Are you there, Mark? Okay, we have the feed. Levine.
I am indeed.
There you are. Hallelujah. Praise God.
I exist. Therefore I am.
Yes. Right. Rene Descartes goes into a bar and the bartender says, would you like a beer today, Mr. Descartes? And he says, I think not. And he disappears.
Ba-dum-bum. I told you that joke.
I know, but I tell it better.
It is my joke.
I tell it better. Comedy is a conspiracy of honorable thieves, Mark. Have you not figured that out yet?
Whatever. Hey, I don't know whether I'm hot or cold or...
You're okay. Pull back a little bit, please, on yours.
I will pull back. Hold on. Let's pull back with this one. How's that? Is that
okay,
good?
Okay, that's good. How's the feed
right.
line?
The feed's good. I'll play for you some feed. Have some feed.
5 votes for Senator Obama.
Perfect.
And 6 votes for Senator...
But I'll turn it down unless you really want to hear the details of every roll call.
Well, has the over-the-top vote been cast yet?
No.
Then I want to hear it.
Waiting to see who wins. Don't you know, Bob?
Oh, we know. Well, I know who's going to cast the deciding vote that puts him over the top, and I want to hear it happen.
All right. No. We're at Iowa. We're at 57. Electoral vote. I'll play some of it to give our listeners.
Yeah, just pot it up there, please.
Represent the great state of Iowa, where it all started for Barack Obama. Back on a cold winter's night in January, Iowans planted the seeds for a new field of dreams for America with Barack Obama's campaign for change. And now it is an honor and my distinct privilege to announce that the Iowa delegation is united for change. With 48 votes for Barack Obama and 9 votes for Senator Hillary Clinton.
Thank you, Iowa. Iowa cast 48 votes for Senator Obama and 9 votes for Senator Clinton. Kansas, you've got 41 votes. How do you cast them?
Madam Secretary, Kansas, the birthplace of the grandparents of Barack Obama. And the home of Barack Obama's mama. A pioneer in wind energy and the home of the greatest governor in the United States, Kathleen Sebelius. And where we will elect Jim Slattery to the United States Senate in 2008. And the home of a great university system, including the Orange Bowl champion Kansas Jayhawks and the NCAA champion Kansas Jayhawks in basketball. Very proudly cast 6 votes for Senator Hillary Clinton. And 34 votes for the next president of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you, Kansas. Thank you to our heartland. Kansas cast 34 votes for Senator Obama, and 6 votes for Senator Clinton. Kentucky. Kentucky, you have 60 votes. How do you cast them?
Madam Secretary, my name is Jennifer Moore, and I'm the youngest.
I'll turn down the feed a bit. I just wanted to give you all a chance to hear some of the roll call vote. Of course, the outcome is not exactly a problem, but we'll try to make sure that you get it back when we go over the top. Bob, I don't know. Bob, I guess, wants me to go. You want me to go back to the feed, Bob? I'll do that.
Well, Mark, I understand you've got Paul Waldman there from Media Matters for America.
I do.
And I know I know Paul's a very busy man. So why don't you?
Let me see if he can wait a bit.
Well,
what do you think?
I think we're about 5-6 states away.
Okay, then let's go ahead. We'll finish the roll call. Here you go.
The All-Tech FEI World Equestrian Games proudly cast 24 votes for Senator Hillary Clinton, and on the celebration and anniversary and bicentennial of that great American, Abraham Lincoln, proudly cast 36 votes for the next president of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you, Governor. Kentucky cast 36 votes for Senator Obama and 24 votes for Senator Clinton. Louisiana, you have 67 votes. How do you cast them?
Louisiana, the home of gumbo, jambalaya, crawfish pie, and also shrimp in the recovery from Katrina. Proudly cast 43 votes for Obama, and here is my colleague, my chair, who will now.
Louisiana, home of the Fighting Tigers, Jaguars, and the Fighting Mary Landrieu, 7 votes for Hillary Clinton.
Woo! Louisiana, thank you for your vote, so we may be sure we have an accurate recording. Would you please restate your vote count?
Restating our vote, 43 for Obama, 7 for Hillary Clinton.
Thank you so much. Louisiana cast 43 votes for Senator Obama and 7 votes for Senator Clinton. Maine, the great state of Maine, 32 votes. How do you cast them?
Madam Secretary, I'm John Knutson, chair of the Maine Democratic Party. I have with me here Mary Ann Stevens, our vice chair, Congressman Mike Michoud from our 2nd District. Here we have our wonderful, wonderful governor, John Baldacci. And we're so proud to be here. The sun comes up in Maine, first in the nation, and we feel very honored to have that as our singular, whatever, privilege. As Maine goes, you've heard this before, so goes the nation. We are the home of Congressman Tom Allen, the man who will take back George Mitchell's seat in the U.S. Senate and move us towards the 60 senators that we desperately want to have. The great state of Maine proudly cast 8 votes for Senator Hillary Clinton, and 24 votes for Senator Barack Obama, the next President of the United States.
Maine, and thank you for your wonderful delegation. Maine cast 24 votes for Senator Obama and 8 votes for Senator Clinton. Maryland. Maryland, you have 100 votes. How do you cast them?
Madam Chair, the great state of Maryland, that state around which other states rally in times of great adversity, Maryland, the original land of the free and home of the brave, is proud to call upon our distinguished son, the Honorable Congressman Elijah Cummings, to give Maryland's votes.
Madam Chair, the great state of Maryland, the birthplace of our Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the birthplace of Harriet Tubman, and the birthplace of the Star-Spangled Banner. We cast proudly our votes for two great Americans. 6 votes for Hillary Clinton, 94 votes for the next president of the United States of America.
Thank you, Maryland. Thank you, Governor. Thank you, Representative. Maryland cast 94 votes for Senator Obama and 6 votes for Senator Clinton. Massachusetts, you have 121 votes. How do you cast them?
The great state of Massachusetts, and I'm joined here, I'm Senator Therese Murray, the first woman president of the Massachusetts.
Yeah.
With my co-chair, our first African-American governor, Deval Patrick. We are the home of Senator Ted Kennedy.
Yes.
The home of the winning Boston Red Sox.
Yeah.
The home of the winning Boston Celtics.
Yeah.
The home of the New England Patriots.
Yeah.
We are the pioneer in universal health care.
Yeah.
We are the birthplace of education.
Yeah.
And we are first in equality in marriage in the United States.
Yes.
Massachusetts proudly cast its vote. 52 for Hillary Clinton.
And 65 votes for the next president of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you, Massachusetts. Massachusetts cast 65 votes for Senator Obama and 52 votes for Senator Clinton. Michigan, welcome, Michigan. Michigan, you have 157 votes. How do you cast them?
Sister Secretary, from the state that has been most devastated by the unfair, failed trade and economic policy of George W. Bush and John McCain, that have shipped our jobs overseas, pushed our gas prices to $4 a gallon, and left all of our children behind. From the state we have most to gain from Barack Obama's presidency, to create jobs by investing in renewable fuel and retooling our manufacturing sector. Michigan tonight proudly cast 27 votes for Senator Hillary Clinton and proudly cast 125 votes.
Thank you, Michigan. Thank you, Michigan. Michigan cast 125 votes for Senator Barack Obama and 27 votes for Senator Clinton. Minnesota. Minnesota, you have 88 votes. How do you cast them?
Minnesota, the home of the winning college
Duluth women's hockey team. Minnesota, the state that believes in the power of people and always has the highest voter turnout in the country. On the 60th anniversary of Minnesota's own Hubert Humphrey's electrifying Democratic convention speech, in which he challenged our country to seize a historic opportunity, Minnesota is proud to be part of this historic convention of change.
Minnesota, which helped launch the draft Obama movement, and Minnesota, where hundreds of volunteers and citizens came out in a record-setting caucus.
All right. It's about 26 minutes past the hour, and Mark Levine has gotten Paul Waldman, our good buddy from Media Matters for America, to join him in the Horn broadcast booth there in the skybox at the Pepsi Center. Mark,
and Paul Waldman is sitting right by me. I'll tell you, I know many of you want to hear Obama going over the top. We will, I promise you, fade back to the hall when Illinois or the state that's going to put him over comes over the top. But for now, I'm going to just interview Paul Waldman.
Yeah, Paul, welcome to the Horn again. We've talked on a number of occasions. Glad to have you here.
I'll tell you what, I'm trying to get some feed to Paul's headphones. You know the way these things work. They're a little... Hang on, just one second. Let me try to get Paul on the headphone. 1 second. Sorry about that, Bob. I'll put the feed up while I do this.
You have 41 votes. How do you cast them?
Madam Secretary, we, Mississippi, home of the late...
I don't have the little doohickey that I'm required to have. So I'll ask Paul the questions. Bob, if you have questions, I'm more than happy to pass them on.
Take it away, Mark.
Paul, I know that you've been studying a certain author by the name of Jerome Corsi. Now, my understanding is before trashing Obama, he was active with the Swift Boat Veterans.
He was. 4 years ago, he was a co-author of a book called
Interesting Man. I'm sorry, Paul. We are having mic trouble. It's been one of those days. One second. I'm going to try to fix Paul's mic. Oh, wait. I think I got it. Wait a minute. It may be that microphone, actually. These are the ones that they give us. I tell you, it's. Tell you what, you want? I know it's crazy. You want to share my microphone? Go ahead.
4 years ago, Corsi was the co-author of a book called Unfit for Command, which was kind of the centerpiece of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth campaign. Now, everybody remembers that, of course, and it was discredited to the point where today we use the term swift boating to denote any scurrilous, false campaign of character assassination against a presidential candidate. So that was what he did 4 years ago. And the real problem with how that played out was that not just that he was a part of this kind of campaign of lies and slander against John Kerry, but that the press didn't do its job. They should have evaluated at the outset whether or not what these guys were saying was true. And then when they found out that it wasn't, they shouldn't have given them any oxygen. But what happened was those charges got kind of circulated around in the media for about a month before anybody took the time to see whether or not they were true. And by the time they actually found out and told the public that they weren't true, it was too late. They were already everywhere.
So Jerome Corsi now is back doing the same thing to Obama. I mean, at least him, you would think, of all people, it should be very easy to discredit because of what he did before.
Well, it's not just that, even. I mean, he has come out with this book called The Obama Nation, and it, like his book about John Kerry, is filled with lies and slanderous accusations and just crazy accusations, distortions. We at MediaMatters.org, we have documented all of this. It's very lengthy. You can go and check it all out. But we've also found out some more things about Corsi. Back in 2002 and 2003, just a few years ago, he posted a series of comments on a right-wing website that were full of bigoted ugliness, calling Muslims ragheads, calling Chelsea Clinton chubby Chelsea, all kinds of juvenile stuff. He was found out, he admitted it, but even today he is going on, he's gone on white supremacist radio shows. He is supposedly teaming up with Floyd Brown, who was the guy who created the Willie Horton ad, in order to do some new round of ads or a documentary against Barack Obama. So
tell me this. What are his most scurrilous charges? And is he saying that he's Muslim or stuff like that? Or what kinds of things?
Yeah, there's a lot of the Muslim stuff. I mean, everyone has heard about this, about the emails that have gone around. What you find when you go through his book is it all lines up pretty closely with those kinds of emails. So he doesn't come out and say that Barack Obama is a practicing Muslim. He talks at length about supposed ties to Islam and says things, you know, have distortions and falsehoods. Like he says, oh, well, Obama's father divorced his mother in accordance with Sharia law. And it turns out when you look at his footnotes that it's sourced to some right-wing Canadian blogger. It's not true. I mean, Obama's father was an atheist. But there's all kinds of little things like that that are sort of meant to tell you that, well, maybe he really is a Muslim. He's got, allegations about Obama injecting himself into the Kenyan elections, which are not true. You know, the truth is Condoleezza Rice asked Obama to make a couple of phone calls to try to calm down the unrest in Kenya. There's all kinds of things like that that go throughout the book.
So I would hope that this time, having been fooled once, they're not going to be fooled again. That the media, with probably the exception of the Fox propaganda channel, that the normal mainstream news stations, other than the Republican propaganda channel Fox News, that the others at least won't take him seriously. Is that happening now?
Yes and no. He certainly has gotten lots of time on Fox. He's been on Hannity and Combs more times than I can count. I have noticed that some of the mainstream press has been a little more skeptical in the way they've approached this and the way they've talked about it. But he and the people who are promoting him have very successfully implemented a strategy they've used before. They basically try to get as many sales as they can in a very short period by using those places like Fox News and like conservative talk radio to promote it, sending it out to mailing lists. In some cases, there are bulk sales. I don't have any specific. I don't know specifically if there have been bulk sales about this. It's almost impossible to find out. But they certainly used that before, large buying up thousands of copies. The goal is then to get the book onto the bestseller list. Once that happens, then the mainstream media will say, well, you know, it's on the bestseller list, so now we have to pay attention to it and treat it seriously.
And presumably, if the mainstream media doesn't take it seriously, the next step of the Fox propaganda channel is to say, hey, it's on the bestseller list. You have to treat this fiction as if it is true, because if you don't, then you're discriminating against conservatives.
Right. So it becomes yet another argument for why there's this supposed liberal bias in the media. If they cover it, then they're going to say that they're covering it the wrong way. If they don't cover it, they're going to say that they're not covering it because they're a bunch of liberals. But the conservatives really have understood for a while that books can be an important piece of their political project. In this case, another case is kind of a link in the chain of propaganda that's very effective.
Now, have there been any bulk purchases? I mean, one of the ways you can get something on the bestseller list is if you sell, a million copies to the Heritage Foundation, they won't use it. They might get a very cheap rate. I don't know, 10 cents a book. But what it would do is it would, at least in numbers, increase the sale.
Yeah, and so, for instance, there's something called the Conservative Book Club that often buys up thousands of copies and almost gives them away. In this case, the Conservative Book Club hasn't been involved because they have their own anti-Obama book. The Conservative Book Club is owned by a company that also owns the most prominent right-wing publisher called Regnery. So they've got their Obama book, so they're not promoting Corsi's. On the Times list, the New York Times puts a little dagger if they've gotten information that there are bulk sales. So there have been bulk sales of Corsi's book, but it's almost impossible to find out to what extent. If it's tens of thousands of copies, thousands, hundreds, we don't really know. We know that there are some bulk sales, but we don't know to what extent it is.
So thank God it hasn't made the bestseller list yet. Is that right?
Well, actually, it has. Corsi's book was on the New York Times bestseller list, and we have heard some members of the media say, well, now we have to do a story about it. You know, I got interviewed for a story that was on All Things Considered on NPR, which most people don't know may have the biggest audience of any media presentation in America. They've probably got 20 million listeners. So they did a story about it. It was a pretty skeptical story. You know, they interviewed me, so that was something. But they still felt like that was the rationale. Because it was on the bestseller list, they had to pay attention to it.
So now, Corsi, we've seen him up here. He seems to be going from radio interview to radio interview. And I got to say, it's tempting. I mean, I'm tempted to interview him just to debunk him. I don't know. Should I? Or would you advocate liberal hosts not interviewing him because he's a fraud?
I think there isn't a simple answer to that question. I do think that he doesn't deserve attention from sort of the mainstream media, quote-unquote, in part because the way that they're going to present him is in that standard he-said-she-said style. He says this, the other side says this, and who knows who might be telling the truth. There have been a couple of more progressive hosts that have really confronted him directly, and I think there is some value in that. I went on Larry King Live and debated him, and it was a good forum because we had enough time for me to really get in some of the real critiques of the book and talk about why it was so false and pernicious. But I think that you can make an argument for a host who's really going to go after him that is a good thing. What I've been doing here at the Pepsi Center is whenever Corsi goes and does an interview, I asked him if he'd like to debate me on the air on one of these radio shows that he's doing. He said no. So I've been going around to the host and saying, okay, you know, you had Corsi on 5 minutes ago. Why don't you let me come on and tell people why his book is so wrong? And most of them have said yes. So
does that include the conservative talk show host? They've included it too?
No. There are only a few conservatives here. Most of the hosts here are either the neutral hosts or the progressive hosts, so I haven't gotten any of those yet.
So let me ask you this. Let's say that we've got people out there. We have a lot of listeners who have colleagues, friends, you know, who do watch the Fox Propaganda Channel, who do listen to Rush Limbaugh, and they hear, oh, of course he says Obama's a Muslim, whatever junk of course he says. Give me two or three things that our listeners can remember that they can tell their friends or colleagues of why Corsi's a fraud in this case.
Well, I think, first of all, you have to understand that I think the most important thing is that his last effort with John Kerry was completely debunked, and everyone acknowledges that across the political spectrum. Everyone acknowledges that. This is the same thing, and there are even conservatives who are trying to distance themselves from him. And that, I think, is very telling, that even some of the people who embraced him 4 years ago are now saying, we don't want to have any part of this. The fact that the guy will go on to white supremacist radio shows and UFO conspiracy theory radio shows you the kind of circles that he's traveling in. And the other thing people should do is they should go to MediaMatters.org because we have a point-by-point refutation with very carefully documented of all the things he got wrong.
Terrific. I'll tell you something. We're coming up. We're now at New Hampshire. New Jersey, New Mexico. I should be able to know my alphabet by now. New Jersey, New Mexico, then New York. I think many of us want to hear what the New York delegation has to say, given it's the home of Hillary Clinton. So I'll tell you this. You said you're going to be around tomorrow at Invesco Field, too. Is that right?
Yes, I will. And it would be great to come back on and talk about this some more.
Well, that'd be great. I'll tell you what I want to do. I'm going to ask to have you come back on. At the same time, I'm going to ask Jerome Corsi to come on, and I'm going to have him on. And I think what I'd like to do is a little bit of an ambush. I'll invite him on, and we'll talk about it. We'll get it organized. I'll invite you to come on 5 minutes later, and then I'll invite you to sit down next to him. At that time, I will have 3 mics working, I promise you. And what we'll do is we'll see if he walks off the set. How'd you like that?
Sounds good to me.
Great. We'll record it and hopefully be something you can use on Media Matters. We're going to try this ambush, but right now I do want to get back to the roll call and see what New York has to say. We're at New Jersey. Paul, I look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Thanks, man. It's been my pleasure.
Been my pleasure, too. All right, let me turn up the feed a bit. We're already at New Mexico.
Garden State.
Excuse me, New Jersey. Then New Mexico, then New York.
Super Bowl champion Giants.
Yeah!
The Boston Bon Jovi,
yeah!
Where the sun rises on our shores and sets over our green mountains in the west, where our people are industrious, entrepreneurial, and every once in a while have an attitude. We, the Democrats, in one of the most trailblazing progressive states in the nation, providing health care, paid family leave, and making sure every child has a quality education, we proudly and unanimously, I repeat, vote for the next president of the United States, a person who will lead us to the change this country needs, who will inspire America with hope and promise, a leader who will inspire the world with hope and promise. We unanimously cast our 127 votes for Barack Obama.
Jersey. Thank you, Governor. New Jersey proudly cast all 127 of its votes for Senator Barack Obama. New Mexico. New Mexico. You have 38 votes. How do you cast them?
Oh, I'm so sorry for interrupting, Madam Secretary. Madam Secretary, our friend, our guest, Austin, in the beautiful land of enchantment. Madam Secretary, the wonderful land of enchantment is here today with our beautiful familia de Nuevo Mexico. La tierra de la gente. La tierra de 22 Native American tribes. The land where we know the Hispanic vote will make the difference to make sure that New Mexico will be a blue state, no ink. The land of enchantment of red and green Chile proudly cast its vote. But yet, we are given the distinct honor and privilege, Madam Secretary, of yielding the floor. A day that all New Mexicans will remember when we yield to the land of Lincoln. The state that loves and knows our Governor Bill Richardson. The home of Diane D. Dennis. The home of United States Senator Jeff Fingerman and Congressman Udall and the Senator-in-Waiting Tom Udall. And the youngest statewide Hispanic elected official, Hector Valderas. Attorney General Gary King and State Auditor Hector Valderas and State Treasurer James B. Lewis. All of us together as a family yield to the beautiful state of Illinois, the home of the next President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. New Mexico yields to Illinois. Illinois, you have 185 votes. How do you cast them?
Madam Secretary, from the great state of Illinois, the land of Lincoln, Ulysses S. Grant, and the home of our senior senator, Dick Durbin, and from the sparkling city of the great city of Chicago as a candidate city for the 2016 Summer Olympics. And in 2008, World Series between the Chicago White Sox and the Chicago Cubs. Hometown of the next president of the United States, Barack Obama. We yield to the great state of New York. Clinton.
Thank you, Illinois. Thank you, Mayor Daley.
Hillary Clinton is now entering the chamber. They're showing her up there before the mic with Chuck Schumer right by her side.
Thank you, Illinois. Thank you, Mayor Daley. New York. New York, you have 282 votes. How do you cast them?
On behalf of the Empire State, the great state of New York, led by its great new governor, Governor David Paterson. The home of its senior senator, Senator Charles Schumer.
the home of the Ways and Means, Chair of the House, Congressman Charlie Rangel, and a great congressional delegation. The home of our great state Democratic chair, June O'Neill.
Not mentioning somebody, interesting.
Our great attorney general, Andrew Cuomo.
Did they forget anyone?
Controller, Tom DiNapoli. I am proud to call upon the great senator from New York to make the following presentation. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Madam Secretary, on behalf of the great state of New York, with appreciation for the spirit and dedication of all who are gathered here, with eyes firmly fixed on the future, in the spirit of unity, with the goal of victory, with faith in our party and our country, let's declare together in one voice, right here, right now, that Barack Obama is our candidate and he will be our president. Madam Secretary, Secretary, I move that the convention suspend the procedural rules and suspend the further conduct of the roll call vote. All votes cast by the delegates will be counted, and that I move Senator Barack Obama of Illinois be selected by this convention by acclamation as the nominee of the Democratic Party for President of the United States.
Well, we'll be waiting for Mark Levine's audio to clear up here in just a moment. I'm sure he'll have that taken care of. Interesting little piece of theater going on there with Hillary Clinton putting Barack Obama over the top. Just got to check the audio there. Telling Mark to reconnect. So we will wait on that. Hopefully he'll be back. It only made sense, especially in light of, like I said, I went around and looked for some stuff earlier today. And lo and behold, you know, I saw the Puma stuff. And I saw where the Pumas, whom I don't want to give any more credence to than I have to, were claiming that, all good, Mark. Pull the feed back. You there, Mark? Mark Levine, this is West Virginia calling. Are you there, Mark Levine?
Well, that was it.
Nice little piece of theater, huh?
I got to say, Bob predicted this. I have to admit it. Go ahead, Bob. Tell him what you said.
No, I just said that this is theater, and if I was stage managing it, I would make sure that Hillary was the one who put his who put him over the top.
And I have to admit, I said, Bob, you read that somewhere, you heard from someone, but I believe him when he denies it. That's exactly what happened, of course. They got enough in the roll call vote, and then they're approaching on New York. They switched to Illinois because traditionally, of course, the home state gets to put the person over the top, and then they went right back to New York.
Yeah, but consider that California ducked.
Well, of course. I mean, yeah, they had to because they had to make this piece of theater here. And, you know, it's interesting, though, that even the numbers, long before you got to that point, made it impossible for Hillary to win. You had states like Massachusetts that voted for Hillary in the primary, but the majority of their people were going for Barack Obama. New Jersey, I think, was a unanimous vote for Obama when, as I recall, New Jersey went for Clinton. So clearly they were doing some stuff behind the scenes to allow this to happen.
And like I said, I think it had to happen, Mark, because, you know, that. Well, I prayed my little prayer at the beginning of the program that we can be miraculously healed from, or some of us can be miraculously healed from our attention deficit disorder and focus on the problem. The problem's name is John McCain. And, you know, the people who refuse to be reconciled to the Democratic ticket as it stands, Mark, were blogging that Hillary was speaking to them in code last night, telling them to vote for McCain.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that nobody said that except for the Fox Propaganda Channel. Other than Fox Prop, everyone else said Hillary did what she had to do, that it was a very strong speech, that it was very powerful, and that she convinced her supporters to do the right thing. Hold on, Nancy Pelosi speaking. Let me just bring it pot up for a second. Of course, everyone's shouting, yes, we can.
Right.
It is with great pride that I announce that Barack Obama is the Democratic nominee for President of the United States by acclamation. Pursuant to Rule C-8 of the Convention Rules and Procedures, Senator Obama has been invited to make an acceptance speech. I have been asked to inform you that Senator Obama accepts the nomination.
That was quick.
And will deliver his acceptance speech tomorrow night at the fourth session of the convention to be held at Invesco Field. Yeah.
You know, if you've got an appreciation for stylized theater, this is the height of it.
Well, it really went, because one of the things is that nobody I talked to in the Democratic Party really felt that this was still a fight. I mean, you got a very, very few Clinton supporters, but honestly, you have to search under rocks to find them, and the media did search under a few rocks, and they did find an extremely small number of people saying that, you know, they'd rather have McCain than Obama, and they used to vote for Hillary, whatever. But no one in the media made a big deal of this except Fox News last night. Hold on, we got Chuck Schumer speaking. Let's listen to him for a bit.
To support our great leader, Hillary Clinton, and now we are equally proud to support Barack Obama. Now, ladies and gentlemen, 69 days from now, the journey that was launched in Springfield, Illinois, and continues here today will culminate with millions of Americans coming out to elect Barack Obama, our next president. And with President Obama leading the way in 2009, we'll take the next step on that path to reverse the disastrous course that George Bush and John McCain and their friends in Washington have set for this country. But Barack Obama cannot do it alone. Without a strong Democratic majority in the Senate, his ambitious agenda will be thwarted by the defenders of the status quo, whose goals can be boiled down to a single word: no. Without a large Democratic majority, President Obama might even have to pare back the breadth and strength of what he proposes. We know what John McCain and his friends in the Senate will do, because we've seen it far too many times in the last 2 years. 92 times they filibustered important legislation to change the direction of this country. When the American people demanded change in Iraq, John McCain and his friends said no. When you demanded legislation to lower the price of gas, John McCain and his friends said no. When you demanded middle-class tax relief, John McCain and his friends said no. When Barack Obama wins in November, John McCain, yes he will go back to the Senate, and he and his friends will go back to saying no, no, no to the change our country so dearly needs. Can we stop them? You know the answer. Yes, we can. But to do it, we need your help. The opportunity is too great, the stakes too high, to allow President Obama's agenda to be blocked by the special interests and their allies in the Senate. So, of course, we must elect Barack Obama president, but when we do, we also must elect many more Democrats to the Senate so we can help Barack Obama lead America on a new course. Now, there are 17 states, where we have a good chance to beat Republicans. Many are states where for decades Democrats have struggled, but now we have a chance to win. This is, ladies and gentlemen, a once-in-a-generation opportunity. So help us win Virginia, Alaska, Colorado, New Mexico, New Hampshire, where our candidates are ahead today. Help us win in Minnesota, Mississippi, Maine, Oregon, Kentucky, and North Carolina, where our candidates are locked today in neck-and-neck races. And help us win in Georgia, Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, and Idaho, where no one ever thought our candidates would run strong races, but they are. So please, go to the website of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee at www.dscc.org and sign up today. Every day, a new secretive 527 or 501 front group, fueled by millions of undisclosed dollars, emerges from the shadows to attack our candidates, and we need your help now. The special interests, the defenders of the status quo, have shown they'll go to any length to stop us from changing Washington, and we need you.
Okay, we're going to cut away from the feed for a little bit and go to Robert Borisaj. Many of you have... go ahead. Bob wants to get an introduction. Go ahead, Bob.
No, go ahead, Mark. That's fine. Good. Do what you're doing.
Well, Robert Borisaj is sitting right next to me. I don't know that those headphones are working, but they're not. That's okay. We've been switching around mics and things as live broadcast. That's what happens. We're not in studio. Robert, tell our listeners who you are, what you do, and then I ask you about an article you recently wrote on Huffington Post.
I'm co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, which is a center of progressive ideas and organizing. We just helped launch the new healthcare coalition, Healthcare for Americans Now, to fight the battle over healthcare over the next few years.
And let me say, the horn has been at many Campaign for American Future, America's Future. I think you've done three of them now, something like that. Six of them. Wow. Okay, so a lot more than I remember. In any case, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is a recent article you wrote in the Huffington Post, which I found very interesting. You talk about the values voters, and of course values, at least ostensibly according to Republicans for many years, were family values, that somehow Republicans stood up for families. I guess they meant families that are, you know, mom and dad and married and 2.3 children, and all of them seem to act like Beaver Cleaver's family. But you were talking about the difference in the family values of Barack Obama and Joe Biden versus John McCain.
Right. I mean, it was very striking after Michelle Obama's speech the other night. She told the story of her childhood where her father with multiple sclerosis got up every day to go to work to raise his son and daughter and to make certain that they had the will and the drive to go to college and help get them through college and, in Michelle's case, through law school. And then she told the story of Barack being raised by a single mother and by his grandparents, making his way, going to college on student loans. Both of them families of working people, both of them great loyalty in the with the parents and the values that really are the values that the conservative movement preaches at churches about what they are for. And Joe Biden, even more so in some ways, raised a Catholic, married, the great tragedy of his life with his wife and his daughter killed in an automobile accident, his two sons injured. And he then dedicated himself as a senator to coming back every night on the train to be with those boys and raise them. Eventually remarried, had another daughter with his new wife, and maintained the same regime where every night he leaves, gets on the train, goes back to Wilmington to be able to be with his family.
Now John McCain doesn't have those same kinds of family values?
Well, McCain's, of course, a very different story, one that he celebrates, right? He was a rake as a young man, kind of famous for his wild ways. He married a model. They had a couple children. And he then went in the military, where, of course, he had the heroic torture as a POW. But while he was in captivity, his wife also suffered an automobile accident. She was crippling injuries. When McCain came out, as he says, the moral failing of his life, he then started to have serial affairs and eventually pursued a young heiress. And then when he captured her, told his wife that he wanted her to divorce him, and he wanted a divorce, and essentially abandoned his marriage with his children, really irreconcilable for many years. Since then, with Cindy McCain, he's had another family, and of course there are rumors about that, which we don't even have to go into here. But the point is that if you are part of the so-called conservative value voters and you are about traditional family values, at the core of that is, of course, against the sin of adultery. Now, in politics, as we know, neither party goes without sins in this area.
Well, that's true, but here's something that I find kind of interesting. I mean, Bill Clinton, very famously, perhaps the most famous adulterer in world history, because the Republicans literally impeached the man, not for a high crime and misdemeanor, but for a fairly low everyday crime, not even a crime, actually, anymore, but moral failing that, let's face it, all too many couples face. Usually it's the man, though not always. It doesn't give me any pleasure to point out that one of my great heroes, Martin Luther King, even had this same moral failing. But Bill Clinton, of course, was impeached for it. And then recently, John Edwards was excoriated for doing what he did to Elizabeth Edwards. And no one, I love Elizabeth Edwards, I assure you, as much as all of America does. She is a fantastic, wonderful woman. We all hope that somehow she can find a miracle cure. None of us are very happy with what John Edwards did. But here's the thing that I find striking, Robert, is that John Edwards' career was pronounced over. It was pronounced by the media over. He is not in this hall. I mean, let's be clear here. Hillary Clinton famously gave her very strong speech. She right now made the difference. She was second, of course, and she endorsed Obama. John Edwards was third. No, I mean, he was a distant third, but he was third. But fourth, Bill Richardson is here. The vice president, chill nominee, Joe Biden, ran for president. Kucinich gave a rousing speech. Chris Dodd's here. I mean, every single person who ran for president is in this room except John Edwards. His career is over. Now, without judging that, all right, that's sort of a separate issue. I don't really care to talk about that. Why is it that John McCain gets a pass from everybody? No one's even talking about it. Most Americans don't even know about it, while John Edwards' career is effectively over.
Well, you can put it to the fact that this happened years ago, and so McCain has been with Cindy McCain since then. And that you know, we give him his failings. But more interesting to me is if you're a values voter and you care about what the presidency teaches your children, there's no question that in this race, the ticket that has the couples that are faithful to one another, that have exhibited the values that Americans say they want their children to see in the White House, is on the Democratic side of the ticket, whereas John McCain has a very different history.
Is it fair or is it not fair for Democrats to raise this issue? We, of course, were not happy that they made such a big deal over Bill Clinton. They impeached him for it. Is it fair or unfair to talk about the fact that John McCain has had a series of affairs with his first wife and there are rumors with his second wife? Or is that dirty politics?
I don't think it's something that we want the election to turn on. We want the election to turn on where this country is going and what are the what are the choices we're going to make about how we operate abroad and what our economy is going to do here at home. And so I think we ought to be waging the battle on that. And on those grounds, the choices are pretty clear. But I do think that there is this kind of underlayer of hypocrisy where there's this tendency of Republicans to claim to be the party of family values, even as they flaunt those values in their private activity. And people just ought to be aware of the fact that if Democrats shouldn't be throwing stones, neither should Republicans. And the notion that one of them is the champion of family values is really belied by the choice you're going to face this fall, where it's really clear where the family values are.
Before you go, I just want to talk a little bit more about the Campaign for America's Future. The Head On Radio Network, of course, is America's liberal voice. We are an independent network. We are not corporate controlled. We are a network that very much reaches out to progressives, and frankly, we could say whatever we want. It's the value of independent radio. It's very rare. Is Campaign for America's Future, I guess, how independent are you? What do you do with your money? What is the purpose of your organization? Why do you exist?
We were set up about a decade ago because 100 activists and leaders came together because they were concerned about the rightward drift of our politics. We believed that we were following a set of policies that were not working for working people, that were developing inequality in the country that couldn't be sustained, and that were endangering our nation. So we set up the campaign to drive issues into the debate and to focus really on bread and butter kitchen table concerns. One of the first big initiatives we did was the coalition to beat Bush on privatizing Social Security. We then launched the Apollo Alliance that brought together labor and green environmentalists and the community groups around a big agenda of jobs and new energy in America. As I said, we're doing the healthcare coalition. We tend to focus on these kitchen table issues and to try to challenge the right-wing economic ideas and policies that have really driven this country into a ditch.
But we live in corporate America. As I said, we, the Head On Radio Network, we are rare. We are independent radio. We are financed by our listeners. It's very rare. How do you avoid, or do you avoid, the problem of corporate ties, corporate sponsorship?
We get no money directly from corporations. We get money, though, from wealthy individuals. We get money from small donors over the web at ourfuture.org. We invite you to contribute. We get money from labor unions, particularly for our CE4 activity. But we stay, kind of champion our independence, and we stay pretty independent. We pick our issues ourselves, often in alliance with other groups. And they are all grounded on what we believe is in the best interest of the vast majority of Americans and working and middle-class Americans who in this economy are really falling behind. I think the problem of corporate money is a very big one, particularly in the Democratic Party. We can see it now where corporations are buying big time into the Democratic congressional committees and the congressional campaigns. And it starts to skew. You know, people start to listen to the people who are helping fund their campaigns. And that's why it requires a mobilized citizenry if we're going to get the kind of change we need. And that's what we're about, is trying to create that mobilization and drive that change.
So, I mean, what are your successes? How have you done it? What is the Campaign for America's Future? What have you done so far, and what do you plan to do?
Well, the first big success was on what Bush called his number one domestic priority for the start of his second term, which was privatizing Social Security, which would have left many more seniors in poverty and many more at risk. We formed a huge coalition. Whatever Bush campaigned for this 60 days across the country with town meetings and press conferences. Wherever he had a press conference, we had one. Wherever he had a closed town meeting, we had an open town meeting. And by the time he finished the 60 days, that his proposal was less popular than it was when he started. And in fact, the Republican Congress didn't even bother to bring it to the floor for a vote. And that was our first big going in the trenches against Bush. And I really started the unraveling of the conservative rule in Washington.
So where do you go from here? What's the next big stop on the agenda? Universal health care, ending our dependence on oil, stopping global warming. What are your priorities?
Well, we're still part of the Apollo Alliance, driving the concerted initiative for new energy and jobs. We've just launched the coalition on affordable health care for all. We're going to do a very big program on rebuilding America and investing in our public infrastructure, our shared spaces, our education, et cetera, all the things that are vital for a vibrant society. And we're going to do a big initiative on what America's strategy is in the global economy, because we can't sustain the one we have now, which benefits the few and not the many.
Just a few more questions. These come from our host, Bob Kincaid, who's out of our central studios in West Virginia. First, he wants to know if you want to comment on the AT&T party in Denver that's drawn some negative press. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, you know, all these conventions are corporate spasms. This is one of the big loopholes in campaign financing, where the corporations can put their logos on their parties, and they come out in large numbers in both parties. And it can get pretty disgusting, actually.
The other question Bob asked is that in West Virginia, one of their real concerns is coal mining, and specifically, you know, mountaintop removal, all the pollution it causes, all the damage to the environment. I don't know if you're doing anything on that, but Bob Kincaid has asked for you. Do you know anything about the Coal River Wind Project?
I don't know about the wind project. We've pushed very strong. You know, if you're going to make the transition to renewable energy, at the end of the day, you're going to have to choose either nuclear or coal as a transition fuel source. And so we in our program call for a lot of research and investment in trying to figure out, can we in fact have clean coal? Can you in fact sequester the pollution and hold it in the earth in a way that would allow us to use our leading natural energy source, which would be coal, in this transition period? But, you know, eventually we've got to get into new technologies, new inventions, new battery sources, much more efficient buildings and appliances, and, of course, renewable sources of all sorts, if we're going to move both to energy independence and to sustainable energy independence, that is one that addresses global warming.
Bob, I don't know if you want to ask him some questions directly. I could do that, or we could move on. Okay. All right. I just want to thank you, Robert, for coming in, for being very patient, for waiting while we waited for the roll call vote. It was definitely historic to see Hillary Clinton indeed put Barack Obama over the top. Thank you so much for coming here on The Horn, and particularly on my show, The Inside Scoop, and I hope we can have you back sometime.
My pleasure.
Well, you heard it. We have and just one more thing. Bob Kincaid asked you to look at coalriverwind.org. What they're doing is they're actually taking mountaintops that are slated for destruction and instead putting windmills on top of them to show how actually wind can give you better and more energy than coal. So he asked you to look into that. All right, thanks, Bob. I appreciate it. Richard Daley is now speaking on the floor of the convention. This, of course, is not the infamous Richard M. Daley of 1968 fame, but his son. He is now the mayor of Chicago. Let's tune in a little bit and hear what he has to say.
For our country, and with your help and your support, he will. Thank you, and it's an honor.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Congressman Robert Wexler of Florida.
Thank you. It is my extraordinary honor to be here representing the great state of Florida. Today, American influence abroad wanes. Our advice is not sought. Our warnings are not heeded. Our standing in the world is at an all-time low. For 7 long years, America has paid a dear price for the national security mistakes of President Bush and John McCain. We entered into an unnecessary war and remained bogged down in Iraq as Afghanistan backslides and the architects of September 11 remained free. On Bush and McCain's watch, we have witnessed the growing influence of a belligerent Iran that has destabilized the Middle East and threatened our ally Israel. John McCain now promises more of the same failed policies that endanger both America and Israel. Under McCain's perverse logic, even if it is broke, don't fix it. Americans have a clear choice in November. Barack Obama offers the change we need. He will responsibly end the war in Iraq, prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons, and turn our focus back to defeating al-Qaeda. We know Barack Obama is the president America needs. He's also the leader and friend Israel needs. And Barack will bring to the White House an unshakable commitment to Israel's security in his heart. In his
book, who is this, Mark?
Barack Obama stands with Israel. Not only his words, but his deeds bear testament to this fact. Barack Obama, not John McCain, led the fight in the Senate for divestment legislation that would deliver powerful economic sanctions against Iran. As president, he will increase the international pressure on Iran and finally get results through direct and tough diplomacy. Results due to his stronger, more engaged American foreign policy. This respected and strategic Obama foreign policy will be best for the security of Israel, our allies worldwide, and America herself. Barack Obama has seen with his own eyes the genuine threats faced by Israelis every day. He recently traveled to the town of Sderot along the Gaza border and met young families who want nothing more than to go about their lives in security and peace. Instead, as they go to work, as they take their children to school, they suffer under the daily terror of rocket attacks. Barack Obama understands the threats Israel faces from Hamas, Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran. And as president, Barack Obama will strongly support Israel's right and capability to defend itself, ensure Israel's qualitative military advantage, and finally make progress toward the goal of a two-state solution that preserves Israel's security as a Jewish state. During his recent trip to Israel, Barack visited Yad Vashem, Jerusalem's Holocaust Memorial, where he recommitted himself to combating anti-Semitism and ending the genocide in Darfur. Because Barack Obama knows that the word never again must have real meaning in our time. That's the leadership we need to keep America strong and allies like Israel secure. Leadership that restores America's global standing under the next great president of the United States, Barack Obama. Thank you. Thank you, Florida.
Oh, dear, Mark. I think we could do 3 hours on that speech alone.
Well, that, of course, was Robert Wexler. I should say that on the floor of the convention, I can see about 25 Israeli flags. people waving them after Robert Wexler's speech. I don't know if we want to talk about it or talk about the next part, which is actually women of the House of Representatives. I see a bunch of women who are ascending the stage. I should say this. Robert Wexler has done a lot to help Obama with the Jewish vote, particularly in Florida.
And that's what that was for. I mean, make no mistake,
that's exactly what that was for. There's no question that's what that was for. Listen, Florida has always been one of those very close states. We all famously know what happened in 2000. Right now, Obama is only 2 points behind in Florida, and it may be partly because of the Jewish vote. There are some Jews that don't think he'd be as strong on Israel as John McCain. Now, Obama has famously gone to AIPAC and said he'd be as strong on Israel as John McCain. And that's exactly what Robert Wexler has done more for Obama in the Jewish community and the pro-Israel community probably than any other single individual.
And, you know, that's a lesson in practical politics. Because while I guess everybody except the Muslim community is going to get pandered to, so you know that had to happen. We've got to try to build this coalition. We've got to try to put together enough of a coalition, Mark, to get Obama elected. And some of that involves saying what people want to hear.
It's more than that, Bob, and I know that you and I don't see eye to eye on Israel always, and that's okay. It's okay to have some differences on the horn, but having worked in Congress, people need to know that the vast majority of members of Congress, and I'm talking 95% of Republicans and 90% of Democrats, support the right of Israel to exist, support Israel's security. You know, we all have differences on, you know, where you could draw the line in the West Bank or Gaza. But I think the great majority of Congress support a two-state solution, support a Palestinian state, but virtually no one in Congress, I don't think there's a single member of Congress, and this includes Keith Ellison, our one Muslim member, not a single one would call for the destruction of Israel as Hamas has.
Golly Moses, no. Nobody wants anybody pushed into the sea. But you'll notice that Keith Ellison is damn sure not going to be speaking at this convention either.
You know, he should be.
I disagree with you, Mark, because if he does, oh lordy, you know, there we go again with the Muslim blood libel, and that's, you know, we got to put that aside.
Keith Ellison is, of course, a very honorable man. I think they should have given him a spot, a fairly small spot, perhaps. You know, it's interesting to me. The only openly gay speaker that I've seen up here. Was Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. Now, you know, I don't think it's because they dissed the senior gay member, Barney Frank. Of course, Barney Frank was a Hillary supporter, but I don't think that's what it was about. And Tammy Baldwin came up here, and she didn't talk about gay rights. She talked about health care, which she cares very strongly about, and I'm not knocking her for that. But I think Democrats understand that while they are far, far better on gay rights than the Republicans, that this is an issue that gives red meat to Republicans. Gay hating is a strong part of the Republican Party, and so let's face it, they're not emphasizing it. I think, honestly, the same goes for Muslims, that while Muslims, I think, have every reason to support Democrats over Republicans, understanding that neither, you know, favors the destruction of Israel, but certainly when you look at anti-discrimination against Muslims, the nastiness, that the severe Muslim nastiness, that's all on the Republican side. So I think they should have had Keith Ellison, just like they had Tammy Baldwin, maybe play a minor role early in the day. But I can absolutely agree it was wrong to exclude him.
Well, I don't necessarily think it was wrong. I think it might have been ethically wrong, but it is not necessarily politically wrong, because again, I can't help bringing forward the fact that the Muslim blood libel has been used against Obama very, very effectively by the right wing, and he doesn't want or need to be within 1,000 miles of that.
You know, the fascinating thing to me is that one of the biggest libels against Obama used in connection with Obama as a Muslim, and by the way, the poll I saw in July, and it may have gotten better, it's now August, almost September, but I saw a poll in early July that showed that 19% of Americans, 1 in 5, thought Obama was a Muslim. But connected with this, in the emails, and yes, I've gotten several of them, it says that Obama took his oath of office
on a Quran.
On the Quran. Now, what's interesting is there was a congressman who...
Well, you know how it is. They all look alike to me.
His name is Keith Ellison. He's the only Muslim member of Congress. He happens to be an African-American as well. And what's interesting is the best liars, Joseph Goebbels, Joseph McCarthy, the best propaganda artists will tell you in the world that the best way to tell a big lie is to mix it up with a tiny grain of truth. In this case, we have an African-American congressman who is a Muslim, who did take his oath of office on the Quran, which I 100% support, by the way. It was a little bit controversial, by the way. Nancy Pelosi, for those of you that hate her, stood by him and said, absolutely, he has the right to do that.
Well, it's not so, the Constitution is quite clear that there shall be no religious test for the holding of office.
Absolutely.
So whatever you take,
you don't need a Bible at all.
You don't need any religious book. If the single most persecuted group in America, the atheists, if an atheist could ever get elected and insisted on taking his oath or her oath of office on, oh, I don't know, how about Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle? If he wanted to do that, that's fine, because it's not constitutional, Mark. It's not even legally required at any level.
In fact, I would argue, of course, it is unconstitutional. If someone wanted to put their hand on any book, there absolutely can be no religious test. You're absolutely right. But here again, they took a little grain of truth, mixed it up, and you're right. But I'll tell you, maybe. Maybe it would have been better. I don't know, Bob. Maybe I'm an optimist. If Keith Ellison had come here and addressed it directly and said, I put my hand on the Quran, Barack Obama didn't. Please don't confuse us. We don't look alike. I mean, maybe he should just come up here and faced it directly. That would have been a news item. What do you think?
No, because these are not issues of intellect. You mentioned that 19%, that statistic you saw in July, Mark, that 19% correlates with the 20% of mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, strychnine drinking, floor-rolling, tongue-speaking, miracle-healing, fundamentalist evangelicals in this country. And this is, after all, Wednesday night, and it's prayer meeting, so it's fair game to be talking about this. those are the same fundamentalist, ignorant, dirt, dumb, family values voters that don't give a rat's ass about starving children but are worried about the blastocysts and snowflake babies. And those people are not going to be swayed by an intellectual argument, Mark. Those people have already made up their, the thin gray settlings between their ears that pass for their minds, and they're not going to be swayed from it because it is a hedge, it is a bolster, it's a flying buttress of their bigotry.
Well, Bob, I got good news for you. At least according to John Fox, the poll I cited was, I think, July 2nd. I said it was from early July. John Fox says it's down to 10% who think he's a Muslim. So if John Fox is right, we actually have made a little bit of progress. How do you like that?
Well, I like that a lot. But the fact that all these people were fed this blood libel out of the pulpit of America's so-called Christian churches. And as a consequence of that, you're not going to get that down to zero.
Oh, no, you're never going to get it down to zero. And the other thing is, just like there are people that say they're going to vote for Barack Obama and then won't because he's black, it's called the Bradley effect after Mayor Tom Bradley of Los Angeles, an African-American who was way ahead in the polls and then barely squeaked through a victory.
Right.
There are people that will now know that the media says Obama's not a Muslim. So maybe they'll tell their pollster that they don't believe Obama's a Muslim, but in their heart of hearts, they think he is. So, I wonder about the Bradley effect with regard to religion as well.
I think it's very much there. Now, I did see another poll today, Mark, from some religion polling hustle that pointed out the interesting religious demographics between the various so-called faith communities. 81% of white evangelicals plan to vote for McCain.
87%.
81.
81%.
Yeah, this is sponsored by Crosswalk.com.
I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. I mean, I have no reason to doubt it.
But see, this is 81% of white evangelicals.
Oh, well, of course. Well, of course.
Now, if you go and you poll inside the African-American community, 70% of evangelicals there say that they're voting for Obama.
Hmm. Now, I think it'd be higher.
it's 70% Obama, 16% not sure, 12%. I want to have a conversation with these people. 12% of African American evangelicals plan to vote for John McCain.
You know, I have talked with some of those people. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, you did. You sat on a panel, didn't you?
No, with a black. I actually brought him on my show.
I remember
a month or two ago. A African American evangelical who wrote a book, and it was fascinating to me to have that discussion with him because I've never met such a schizophrenic guy in my life. You know, at least in a white evangelical, most of them are fairly consistent. You know, they hate the gays, they want to control the fetuses and be damned the children. It's all pretty clear. This guy actually made some sense from time to time, and he sort of wavered back and forth. He seemed to care about the poor. I think actually it's very hard to be an African American evangelical, and yet ironically, the black church is still extremely strong, and those pastors are still spouting a lot of that.
Well, but you know, so you've met those folks, but I said I want to meet those 12%. No. The folks I'd like to talk to are those 16% that aren't sure. It's that, you know, this campaign. I feel like this campaign's been going on since my 12th birthday. Okay.
I'll tell you who they are, Bob, because I met one of them at this. I spoke at that church, and I talk with people like that, and they remind me of one of my favorite listeners, who I guarantee you will vote for John McCain. But a listener that's been around the Inside Scoop since long before the horn. Her name is Vicky. She lives in upstate New York. She is a white evangelical. She listens to the show because she wants to hear a different point of view, which makes her more open-minded than 90% of them.
Yeah, hear that.
But Vicky is a one-issue voter. She will admit it. She is pro-life.
She's voting for the little fetuses.
She believes that a blastocyst is a live human being, and to get rid of it is murder. And she cannot be dissuaded by that. That is what her religion teaches. And there's no way to dissuade her. I mean, that's not one of those logical things where you can say, well, you know, it's logically proven that shale oil causes more pollution than fossil fuels, which it is, or causes global warming, which it is. That's science. Whether or not a blastocyst has the same human dignity as you and me, that ain't something that is what Barack Obama famously said, interestingly, before Rick Warren, the pastor. He said, that's above my pay grade. That's not something, I mean,
well, it's not above mine because, you know what, a blastocyst has no perception.
True.
Because a blastocyst has no brain.
True.
But you're dealing with in talking about this individual, you said, you know, she believes that a blastocyst is a human being. And that's the problem. That's one of those groups you're just going to have to write them off forever, Mark, because they're believing. The most hateful word in the English language is I believe, because it means you have forsworn your intellect. As long as
about someone like Vicky and also the black evangelicals that were undecided, is that many of them care about the environment. Many of them care about the poor. Many of them hate the economy. Many of them even are against the Iraq war.
But as long as some right wing freak Repiglican is willing to say, I stand up for the little fetuses, then they will screw themselves in the wallet, they'll screw themselves in their water, they'll screw themselves in the air that they breathe, they'll watch this country drive itself into absolute penury with stupid, drop-dead, idiotic, the bloodthirsty, evil wars and occupations. They'll do all of that and let it slide by and say, but Jesus loves me because I voted to protect the fetuses. So you got to write them off.
We do. But that's who the 12% is.
And see, that's it is.
African Americans who love Obama, who want the first black president, who are very race conscious, very conscious of the persecution that whites have done to blacks and continue to do, but particularly throughout our history, and yet the fetuses. What can I say, Bob? I know the reason. I've talked with these people. That's them.
Yeah, I know. Makes you crazy.
It really does.
And, the Rick Warren, you mentioned Rick Warren. I'm still scratching my head over that. I know you think it was the right thing to do, But I
think it was the political thing to do, just like you think not having Keith Ellison was the political thing to do, and I actually think they should have, so we disagree on that. But I do think that going to Rick Warren, as much as I hate it, I hate it. I just, there is no religious test. The Constitution says so.
No, I just looked at Rick Warren and thought, you know, I would never leave a child around you. Oh, brr, nasty. But no, you know how I was schooled. You know how I was brought up. Yeah, I looked at poor Barack Obama sitting there trying to talk to that fork-tongued devil, and the words of the, you know, I don't know what they are in Hebrew, but the words of the King James Version of the 23rd Psalm kept just banging through my head. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies.
That's pretty accurate. That translation works.
And that's exactly what it was. I mean, it was set up. It was dummied up. John McCain wasn't even in the building. So Rick Warren has to ask the preemptive, you know, how was your cone of silence, Senator, question when he wasn't in the building for the first 30 minutes. And then when the McCain campaign gets called on it, they said, well, he wasn't anywhere that he could see what was going on. Because, you know, they're sleazy and they understand that they can parse words. He wasn't, but you're damn sure you can be damn sure that an aide was, because he was sitting there. McCain, who is not known for being the most quick-witted or quick on his feet, was sitting there itching to answer the questions.
Yeah, it's like he answered them before they were asked.
Yeah,
that would have been funny. Wouldn't that have been funny if he started answering it like, oh, wait, you haven't asked the question yet?
Oh, that was that other question. Well, it damn near happened, Mark. So, as far as tonight's schedule is concerned, I just checked the updated schedule. They're saying Bill Clinton will be along about 9 o'clock Eastern time and that Joe Biden follows him.
Let me give you the immediate schedule, because I think you'll be interested. We've got three people. We got Elijah Cummings speaking now. Then three, four people I don't think you'll be interested in. But guess who's coming next? I don't know if you want to hear him or not. If you don't want to, we won't play him. But your senator, Jay Rockefeller, is giving a speech. Do you want to hear him?
Yeah, I think we kind of got to do. I ran Joe Manchin last night thinking he'd give the big coal whore speech, but it turned out I was wrong and he didn't. So I'm batting about 50-50. It'll be interesting to see what J4 does. You know, Mr. sell the Constitution down the road. You know, Jay Rockefeller. Yeah, that guy.
After Jay Rockefeller, I misspoke when I said that the only openly gay person was Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin, because after him, we've got a live performance by Melissa Etheridge, who I've got to say, I've always loved Melissa Etheridge. I loved her before she came out. I like her even more after she came out. And I can tell you, as a gay man, she's one sexy woman. But but she's going to sing a song, and I don't know. I might want to play that.
Oh, I think we absolutely do. And because, among other things, Guy James was there earlier today for the sound check, and he said this is going to rock.
Oh, she's great. She's just great. She's always been great. Then there's a video on first-time delegates, and then we've got perhaps the person with the least charisma of any Democrat. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Harry Reid?
Yes! Hey, you win! You win the prize, yes.
Am I good or what? I mean,
we did not plan this, folks, I assure you.
We could do the Kreskin thing. I mean, you know, get me the robe with the moon and stars on it and the magic eight ball and blindfold me. Sure.
Yes, Mr. Least Charisma in the Democratic Party, Harry Reid. Then we've got a parade of some military people. We've got a female sergeant. We've got Pat Murphy, joined by Iraq War veterans. After that, Madeleine Albright. And I don't know what you think of her. I've always been a fan of Madeleine Albright. I just think she's got...
I
disagree on that. I think she's got dignity and class.
No. She's got all those things. But even it's one of those things that it's kind of hard for... It's hard to recant on, but... you know, way back when they asked Madeleine Albright, they said, Madam Secretary, statistics now indicate that over 1 million Iraqi children are dead as a direct and proximate result of the sanctions and blockades. Do you really think it's worth it? And she said, absolutely.
Bob, you and I are going to disagree on this. First of all, it's one of those things, you know, I remember back when I studied food crises. It's one of those classes I took, one of those economics classes I took in college. And one of the things we learned in that class was that there's more than enough food on Earth to feed every human being.
Sure there is.
And that the only reason we have starvation in the 20th century and now 21st century is entirely because of politics. And the question is, was it Saddam Hussein starving those kids, or was it us starving those kids? And I got to disagree with you, Bob. I think it was Saddam Hussein starving those
kids. We were the ones who weren't letting the supplies through.
Well, there was an oil for food program, and it was corrupt.
A lot of Republicans benefited from it and were actively engaged in it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But my point is that I support sanctions. You and I can disagree on this. One of the reasons that I felt that we shouldn't have gone to war in Iraq is that I felt that the best way to contain Saddam Hussein was through sanctions. I'm a big believer in sanctions. I'd consider sanctions if Russia doesn't immediately, leave Georgia. I consider sanctions against Iran. I'm not a big fan of war, but I saw how sanctions stopped the apartheid government of South Africa, and it seems to me they are the most powerful diplomatic thing you can do to a country other than force, which I really want as a last resort. So, I guess you and I could just disagree on that.
Look, as compared with, say, Kinda Sleazy Rice, Madeleine Albright's got it all over. As compared with, say, Henry Kissinger, Madeleine Albright's got it all over him. You know, it's a sliding scale. I understand that. And
Do you like Secretary of State? Because I got to tell you, Joe Biden also supported those sanctions.
Oh, I know he did. I know he did. And we're gonna have a problem with the moral and progressive wing of the party over all that stuff. But one of the things at least that Joe Biden has going for him is that he has stepped back. I would say in the long run, Hillary Clinton's inability to apologize and say that she was wrong for voting for George's war cost her the nomination.
I agree with that.
Joe Biden came out and did say that.
He did, and I'm not taking credit for this, but heck, I'm going to take credit for this. A year ago, I attended one of those perennial radio conventions where I go masochistically and am one of, three non-right-wing conservatives in the room. Partly, it's to get intel on the enemy. And partly it's to persuade people that, hey, we do have at least half the country, now I think 70% of the country, that doesn't believe in the policies of Bush and Cheney. Any case, we had Joe Biden speak at one of those things. I guess they were trying to be fair and balanced. And he gave a 25-minute, pretty good speech, got tepid applause, a couple questions in the hall. I raised my hand. They didn't give the mic to me because they know that I ask good questions that are not supportive of the Bush agenda. Anyway, the reason I'm telling you this story is that as Biden was leaving in the hall, I approached him, and I said to him, Senator Biden, I understand you're running for president. Yes, he is. Let me tell you something. Your position on Iraq is the reason why you will not become the Democratic nominee. I said that to his face. And to Biden's credit, he didn't take it as an insult. He didn't take it as, this is some crazy guy, spouting at me. He and I had a one-hour conversation in the hallway. His speech in the hall was 20 minutes, 25 minutes. There were maybe 10 minutes of questions. We talked twice as long out in the hallway. It was great. There were like 50 people around us, just he and I, and we were talking all about Iraq. And he agreed with me on that day that within 6 weeks he was going to apologize for his stand, that he was wrong, that he recognized that he was wrong, that he thought that maybe another president could have done the job, but certainly he was wrong to trust George Bush, and that Iraq is a clear failure, and he was going to come out and change his mind. Now, I'm not saying I convinced him to do it, but I will say this. It was at least on his mind enough that in our conversation, he made that promise to me. I announced it on the Inside Scoop, and lo and behold, 6 weeks later, he did make that renunciation. So I like to think I had a little role in history there.
And the fact that we went through an election cycle in 2004, Mark, in which George Bush couldn't find a single thing he had done wrong. You remember that whole flap?
Oh, right, I do.
I think we have to show that we are we are considered people. There's a difference between being convinced you're right and being willing to think about what constitutes right and wrong. And, you know, the classic definition of insanity is persisting in doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. That's what we've got out of the Bush administration. And hopefully Biden will show that it's not what we will have out of an Obama administration. And I know, because I hear from a lot of dedicated and concerned liberals and progressives, whatever name you wish to attach to them, there are a lot of people out there saying that Joe Biden is just a nightmare. Oh, this is wrong, blah, blah, blah. And you know, what the comment I got the other day is, sure, as among Cain, Bi, or Biden, Biden is the best of the lot. But dear Lord Bob, how did we get to those three?
But let me say something about Joe Biden, okay? Whatever his views on any specific issue, and, you know, get me on credit cards and I will be fiercely condemning Joe Biden. But I'll tell you this. Just the fact that I, you know, talk radio host on the horn, he didn't know who I was. I mean, I used to work in Congress, but I didn't work with Joe Biden. In fact, I did more work with Hillary Clinton. Just didn't happen to be doing foreign policy. I did, you know, judiciary, homeland security work. In any case, he didn't know me from Adam. I asked him a very tough question. I told him he wasn't going to get the nomination unless he changed his position on Iraq. I expected him to just walk away. We had a one-hour conversation. In fact, I mean, he literally put his hand on my shoulder, which is a little weird. I don't know. It was a little uncomfortable. But he was intent. He was staring me right in the eye. And it was back and forth. And you know me, Bob. I don't back down easily. We had a discussion. We talked about everything. We talked about dividing the country into Shia, Sunni, and Kurd. We talked about the Gulf War of 91. We talked about the best way to bring democracy to Iraq, you know, the surge. We covered everything. And the fascinating thing was, as the room started emptying out and the hallway was so crowded, nobody could get by, there wasn't nearly this discussion in the hall. And my point is this. Biden does not shy away from tough questions. And you got to give credit to a man who's willing to face someone who was criticizing him, you know, me. And he was willing, and I got to tell you something else about Biden. His answers were not pat. They were not spin bites. They were not, I mean, I know it's
no, they were considered.
They truly were, and he would pause and think about it and come back at me with this. And I think we kind of came to a compromise. We didn't fully see eye to eye at the end of our discussion. But I think we both gave a little bit. He taught me some things, and I like to think I taught him some things. I could tell that his, you know, I mean, by the end of our conversations, as I said, he was promising me within 6 weeks he was going to publicly change his position. That wasn't what he said at the start of our conversation. So
look,
I've got
a considerable amount of respect for the man, because when you bear up under adversity, here's a guy who started his Senate career literally. With his wife and daughter being killed in a car wreck. All right.
Right. Right. 29 years old.
Yeah, yeah. He took the oath of office standing by his son's bedside as he was trying to recover from the wreck.
Right.
And in you know probably better than anyone else, Mark, living in D.C. How many politicians? How many elected representatives have a little condo in Georgetown, or across, you know what I mean? Oodles of them.
Most of them. Most of them. The great majority of them.
Yeah. Well, Joe Biden doesn't. He gets on the train and he is ridden home to Delaware every night to be there with his sons and with his daughter.
I have ridden that train. It's 2 hours. From Washington Union Station to Wilmington, Delaware. 2 hours each way. It's one way, folks, not round trip. 2 hours every single day. That's a 4-hour commute.
Yeah, that's not a personal helicopter. That's not being delivered. That's not being delivered by a limousine. That's meat and potatoes. And you know what? Honest to God, that means something to me, Mark. I know that, you know, I'm not going to, there's not an individual out there who has voted 100% of the time the way I wanted him to vote.
Although Russ Feingold is close.
Yeah, but he's got a couple of screw-ups. He's on my list for a couple of things, too.
But no, listen, the only way you ever could get 100% in politics is if you yourself run.
And bingo!
Even if you run, you might disagree with yourself after a few years. It might even only be 99%.
Yeah, that's the one where you look up and go, oh, boy.
Did I do that? I'll tell you, though, out of 100 members of the Senate, you can go through by wealth. McCain's up there at the top. John Kerry's up there at the top. Ted Kennedy's up there at the top. The 100th richest senator, in other words, the poorest senator in the Senate, is Joe Biden. He's got only one house, and it's in Wilmington, Delaware. It
yeah.
is very interesting.
He's also the least, and I didn't realize, he is the least richest member of the United States Senate by a long shot.
That's what I said. He's number 100.
Yeah.
Out of 100.
I mean, and even I even learned a little bit where the credit card, you know, the bankruptcy bill, you know, I could wear him out on that.
Oh, I could too. I hate the bankruptcy
bill. And
it happened.
And when you think about the sellout that we got stuck with on FISA, you think back, but you know, there was the god of the Senate, Robert Byrd, voting with Joe Biden on that heinous bankruptcy bill. And everybody said, "Wow, you know, that's because he's Joe Biden D MasterCard." I saw a number the other day, Mark, and I'm assuming that it's true. Over the course of his career, he has received something on the order of $220,000 from the credit card industry. Do the math. $220,000 divided by 36.
That's less than $10,000 a year. $8,000, something like that.
Yeah. Lord knows. Jay Rockefeller? He got that in a year from Verizon. He got 20 grand off Verizon, for his vote on FISA.
Yeah, but Bob, your senator saved the guy, saved Verizon millions and millions of dollars when they broke the law and spied on Americans. So, you know, they made their money.
Oh, that was a bargain.
Speaking of Senator Jay Rockefeller, guess who we have next? Let's all hear.
You know, there's a little bit of this that feels like you and I are doing the color commentary on the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And here comes
Perhaps.
The Popeye balloon.
Here comes Senator Jay Rockefeller.
Good evening. I'm Jay Rockefeller, and I'm from West Virginia, and I am proud of it. Proud of West Virginia's soaring mountains and our solid values.
How dare
proud
he?
That we fly our nation's flag on every front porch. Proud that we never take our families, our neighbors, and our faith in God for granted. And very proud that so many West Virginians serve in our military. I carry the people of West Virginia with me every day in my fight for good jobs, health care, veterans, and our national security. And tonight, we are all proud to stand with two patriots with the judgment and the courage to face down the threats of the 21st century. The next Vice President, Joe Biden, and the next President of the United States, Barack Obama. As chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, I've learned a lot about the nature and identity of our enemies. I have seen the intelligence up close, and I can tell you that the threats that we face are real and they are growing. Make no mistake, please. Our adversaries are determined, they're malicious. They seek the most destructive weapons possible. We are threatened by loose nuclear weapons, terrorist sleeper cells, suicide bombers, cyber attacks, and bioterrorism. And our strength is profoundly undermined by our reliance on unstable regimes for foreign oil. The grim reality is that 8 years of ineffective leadership in the White House has compromised our national security and made America more vulnerable. I have seen the failures of Bush-Cheney up close. We cannot afford even one more day of ideological decision-making, politicizing intelligence, bungling diplomacy, and obsolete thinking.
and we cannot afford to keep sending our troops to fight tour after tour in Iraq while we are distracted from the fight against Al-Qaeda. Our military is powerful. Our military is unmatched. Our courageous men and women in uniform will always prevail on the battlefield. But they deserve a commander-in-chief who will give them a clear mission. We need a smart, tough, 21st century approach to national security. Look, our next president will inherit a long list of challenges: war in Iraq and Afghanistan, global confrontation with Al-Qaeda, the reemergence of a very belligerent Russia, and the wholly unacceptable nuclear ambitions of Iran. And I ask you, shouldn't we have captured Osama bin Laden by now? The American people deserve a leader who can forge strategic alliances where America leads and others follow. Barack Obama is that leader. We need a leader who will establish America as an energy superpower by pursuing every resource at our disposal, alternative fuels, drilling, all of it, and our most abundant domestic resource, and that is, yes, tomorrow's clean coal.
Knew it.
And it is time for Americans to have a leader who will tell them the truth about the challenges that we face and trust them to rise together, to clear any hurdle, fight any enemy, and win any battle. Barack Obama is that leader. We need a leader who sees the world as it is and will be, not as it was several decades ago. We need a leader who will finally end the war in Iraq responsibly so we can focus on the threats of the 21st century. Barack Obama is that leader.
Wow, if he got any more excited, I think he might
Senate,
wake up.
I've worked very closely with Barack Obama, and I can tell you with all of my heart that this man, at this crucial moment, is exactly the strong, steady hand that America needs. He understands the use of force to defeat terror. He understands the role of the strong military with up-to-date weapons and good intelligence. And he will command our armed forces the right way. And when? And Barack Obama also understands that our nation is strongest abroad when we are strongest here at home. He understands that when our democracy thrives, our economy booms, and our homeland is secure, America is unstoppable. John McCain has served this country with honor, but John McCain's refusal to change course, his refusal to offer a plan to get us out of Iraq, even in the face of the failed policies of Bush Cheney, is reckless and will not keep us safe. John McCain views the world through Cold War glasses. He does not see the complexity of counterterrorism in a new century. Barack Obama's vision is very clear. Barack Obama understands
that no challenge is without a solution, because we are America. And we are the toughest, hardest working people in this world. And we are a nation of problem solvers. And with Barack Obama as our president, we will prevail. Thank you. God bless you.
Oh, please turn it down, Mark.
America.
Please turn it down, Mark.
Go ahead. Rail on him as much as you want. Then I want to hear Melissa Etheridge.
Oh, Jesus. I don't know where to start. You know, the coal horn had to come out because it reminds me that, you know, and this is so difficult for me because I'm sitting here, you got to come together, got to have unity, got to beat it, because this guy's better than Obama.
I know you're stewing. I knew this would try to
And all of that is true. Obama is better than McCain, but there have been deals made with the devil, and I know by God that they've been made, because Jay was squiring Obama around in Ohio and West Virginia, and Obama was talking about turning Appalachia into the Saudi Arabia of the United States. But that's not all. God, how many times do we have it? It's bad enough the Republicans do it, Mark. Damn, do the Democrats have to perpetuate this myth of big, bad, dangerous Iran? I mean, my God, isn't it enough just to say, look, bastards, you get a nuclear weapon and you aim it at us, we're going to turn you into glass. Okay? I mean, that's all there is to it. Now, that's probably a little more hawkish than anybody that listens to this network wants to hear me say, but that's about the best we can hope for. Right now, they're still they're making crap up.
The worst part about Rockefeller is when we needed him, at the time when there was bad intel in Iraq, at the time that we did rely on curveball, at the time that we did warrantless wiretapping, and they passed a note to Jay Rockefeller, and he could have done something about it. Nothing. The reason why we have telecom immunity, Bob, don't blame Obama.
We got
the other person. It's your senator. But you know what? Before we condemn him further, I got to hear Melissa Etheridge. I'm sorry.
Okay, then we'll take a phone call.
Cheer you up. This will cheer you up.
Then we'll take a phone call.
Okay.
Land that I love, stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the ocean wide with foam. America, my home, sweet home. Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If you're tired, saving. You better stop swimming or you're gonna sink like a stone, for the times they are changing.
The crowd is singing along. I don't know if you can hear it. Give peace a chance.
That was worth it.
That may be the most deafening roar I've heard in the convention so far. People really enjoy that.
No, she's a treasure. She's
all right,
just
I will put down the feed.
Yeah, because Harry Reid's coming, right?
Yeah, he is.
And Harry Reid is. I'd rather go to our phones and talk to our callers because, frankly, Harry Reid is just slightly more boring than watching sea monkeys grow.
Well, there is watching wallpaper peel.
No, that's a hell of a lot more interesting because you never know where it's going to peel next.
I see. Okay, well, let's go to our callers.
Yeah, let's go to our callers. Our buddy Philip is with us from San Diego. Hey, Philip, welcome to the program.
I've had enough of hearing old bastards today anyhow. So, he was saying give peace a chance. You know, I've heard a couple of speeches today where they're not giving peace a chance at all. Let's start with Wexler and all this fear-mongering about Iran. It's bad enough, you know, I've got to hear the right-wing nutbag, knuckle-dragger, mouth-breeding idiots have to talk about that crap. But to hear a speech, you know, I understand what he was doing. He's trying to make it look like, okay, yeah, Barack Obama supports Israel, he's not Muslim. But for God's sake, you know, the weapons inspectors over there, all the reports that are out indicate that Iran is not making a nuclear weapon right now, as far as I know. But yet for 2 years, this started back in 2006 with the Bush crime family, start to perpetuate the myth that Iran is the threat, and feeding us the same crap that we were fed before 2003. Now here we are in 2008, we're being fed the same crap about Iran. And it's bad enough to hear the right-wing nutbags, Bill O'Reilly and all these other scumbags talk about that. But now we've got to hear Wexler and a Democrat at the Democrat convention talk about that and perpetuate that myth. How are you going to have peace if you're threatening countries like that and running your mouth about that?
I don't see how you can. But I'm
biting my tongue. But
well, I know you are because Mark, you think the Iranians are going to, you know, just start eating human flesh any day.
I think what the Iranians are going to do in days or weeks or months. What we're talking about is since 2006, this myth by the Bush crime family that Iran is the new threat because the Osama bin Laden threat, the boogeyman with that wasn't working anymore. So they needed another boogeyman.
Iraq's in the toilet. Afghanistan's in the toilet. They need a shiny new war because they like their wars new and shiny. And, yeah, Philip, why are we falling into that? Let me just ask you, and, Philip, you tell me what you think. A little bit ago, Mark and I were talking about, well, you know, it was necessary for Wexler to get in there and you know, wave the bloody shirt a little bit. And, you know, by the same token, what I said about why they're probably staying as far away from Keith Ellison as they can. Is it necessary? Is it absolutely necessary, you know, so that nobody can say that, well, we're soft on something. Is it necessary? Is that what this is, that we've got to wave the bloody shirt to appease the people who are
dumbasses
and live in terror? Is that what it is?
You know, I realize I'm in the minority on this one. But to me, Iraq was like crying wolf. I never felt that Iraq was the threat that Iran is. And it's not the threat to the Iranian people. I've done shows. I mean, there's no question the Iranian people are more pro-American than any other people in the Middle East. But it is run by mullahs. They do not have the best interests of America or the region at heart. And, yes, I do think we should try to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. No, not by invading them.
But don't we have to prove first that they're trying to?
I think there's no question, Bob.
Doesn't Iran have the right to protect themselves? They're surrounded by us in Iraq, the other countries around Israel that we've armed. You know, it's not as brilliant.
Israel's no threat to Iran.
Stuff like that, okay? It's against the neocon government that's in Israel now, and I'm not too sure that government's operating in the best interest of the Israeli people either. But my
you know, it's interesting, Philip. The government of Israel, there's going to be an election in Israel, and it costs a couple of months. The Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, is corrupt. It's not based at all on peace issues. It's based on the fact that they got a corrupt Prime Minister that needs to go. But his party, the Kadima Party, at this point is on the left of Israel. If there's an election, it's quite likely, and I don't know what's going to happen, but it's quite likely that Benjamin Netanyahu is going to win. You know, Olmert believes in a two-state solution. Olmert believes in negotiating with the Palestinian Authority. He's seen on the Israel side as not at all neocon, but on the left. It's very interesting to me, Netanyahu, who's on the right, even he told the neocons, don't go into Iraq. They asked him. They asked him back in the 90s, should we go into Iraq? Should we depose him? And even Netanyahu, and he's far to the right of Israel, he's as right as they go, basically, and still, you know, be in the Knesset.
Yeah, and he said, and probably wisely so, Mark, because he understood that it would create a power vacuum in the region that only Iran could fill.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
But, so, you know, you said something a minute ago. You just blithely said, oh, Israel's no threat to Iran.
It isn't.
Try for a moment, Mark, to step into the other guy's shoes. A guy has 200 guns pointed at your head and says, I'm no threat to you. Wouldn't you want one gun at least?
Bob, Iran and Israel, Iran under the Shah, okay, who was a vicious dictator, let's face it, American supported, had extremely strong alliance, very, very strong. And, you know, Israel certainly is no threat to Iran. Israel can't invade Iran. The only reason Israel is scared of Iran is because Iran has said it wants to wipe Israel off the map.
But Israel has two. Go, Phil.
Mark's taken out of context, first of all. And secondly, as far as Iran goes.
They weren't taken out of context. There was a whole Holocaust denial seminar where they invited David Duke, that wonderful Ku Klux Klanner, to represent the Americans in there denying the Holocaust.
You're right.
And a number of hardcore ultra-Orthodox rabbis from Israel, it should be noted.
Well, there's only about 19 of them that exist, but yeah, he had them all there.
two weeks ago, there was a story out, I think on the AP, that the Israel government was considering, doing a preemptive strike in Iraq.
You mean in Iran?
In Iran, yeah.
I think you mean in Iran.
No, he's saying Iran, Mark.
Iran.
I thought he said Iraq. Okay, I thought you said Iraq. I apologize. Go ahead.
So, you know, that story was out, too. So,
you know.
But, Mark,
you know, I want to get into a big debate now about Israel, whether it's right or wrong or Iran. The point here is, Wexler, in the comments, do we have to come out with all the kind of statements he made, or can we just say, you know, look, Barack Obama is going to take a more sensible approach to Iran instead of making threats and stuff
and Phil,
we are going to really see if there is a problem with Iran, and he will defend us and Israel if there is.
Philip, your question is legitimate, but the problem is, again, we're playing to interest groups. And Wexler,
Philip, let me tell you about my. Oh, go ahead.
If Wexler could have gotten away with it, he would have come out on stage and bitten the arm off of an Iranian baby. That's what it takes with the voters who think that, oh, the Democrats don't love Israel enough. No, it's true, Mark. Did you hear him roaring and growling? It was horrifying.
That was just totally unnecessary, though, at the convention. That's something for Barack Obama to talk about himself, you know, maybe in a little better way on the campaign trail after the convention. I just didn't think it was needed. And then we got this
Rockefeller,
Republican or a Democrat?
Well, Rockefeller's always been a Republican, but that goes.
Rockefeller's terrible. Let me just tell you about some of my relatives. I'm just going to say the facts, and you can take it however you like.
Okay.
I have a number of relatives who voted for Gore, who voted for Kerry, who voted for Clinton, who are considering, these aren't my close relatives, but they are cousins. I mean, I know them pretty well. They are considering John McCain, and yes, the issue is Israel. They are concerned that Barack Obama is not sufficiently strong on Israel, and Robert Wexler is reaching out to them. And I got to tell you the truth, I send comments by Robert Wexler to these relatives to convince them to vote for Obama.
Right.
So is that necessary for my relatives, some of whom live in Florida? It is. Whether it convinces them or not, I don't know. But that's who he's playing to. I mean, let's just be clear.
And the delicate balance is always, who are you running off at the same time that you're pandering to? You know, when you pander to one, you piss off another. And that's the balance that they have to strike. And it's it's the same thing that Jay Rockefeller was trying to do, guys. I mean, Lord God, Billy Bob. Yeah, I knew that the West Virginia delegation could not get through this convention. Joe Manchin didn't do it, but Jay Ford did. get up there and talk about damned old filthy-ass clean coal. So,
go for it, Bob. I didn't give you a chance to really rant because Melissa Etheridge came and we all wanted to hear her. Go rant.
Well, no, Philip, if you don't mind, is there anything? Can I? Let me offer you the last word.
Go ahead and rant then.
Well, we've got somebody who can probably rant a lot better about Jay Rockefeller than I can, and I'd like to bring him on the air. So if you don't mind, I'll move along for the time being, but I hope we'll hear from you again, Philip.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks for calling, Philip.
All right, thank you. And, you know, Mark, I love you like family, but bless your heart. I understand why Wexler did what he did, but it scares the life out of me when we go repeating the right wing's memes. You know what I mean? So,
at the end of the day, I think actually diplomacy can prevent war with Iran, but at the same time, it's got to be a tough diplomacy. And actually, I think Obama will do a good job. I think he's the kind of guy who can carry the carrot and the stick, who can talk with the Iranian officials, and who can get them to back down, because the great majority of the Iranian people want good ties with the United States of America. They've got a terrible government, and Obama can maybe go over their government's heads and talk to them in a way that George Bush could never do. So I think that.
And he said the other day he wanted more intensive diplomacy with Iran, and
right.
that's hopeful. And so.
Right, and I think that all diplomacy, you have to have in the back of your mind, in the back there, the threat of force. I think that, frankly, if we had a president other than George W. Bush who understood that the threat of force is mostly a bluff, it's 99% a bluff, but it's got to be there just so that people listen to you. We could have had good diplomacy in Iraq. I mean, after all, when we threatened force, Saddam Hussein allowed the inspectors in. And a normal president, I don't know, Bill Clinton, would have said, okay, you back down, we win. And that's it.
Yeah, by the way, North Korea is thinking about cranking its reactor up again, Mark. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, no.
Because they're pissed off at the loyal Bushies. Email rolling in, subject line, huh? Israel's no threat to Iran? Really? I'm turning to alcohol right now. Good night, Bob.
You know, I don't think it is.
Someday you're going to have to take a walk in the other guy's moccasins, Mark. That's just all there is to it.
Well, it's very simple. I mean, Israel's trying to protect itself.
There's 200 guns pointed at your head, and you and the guy with 200 guns says, "But I'm not a threat." You know?
Well, the guy with the guns pointed to his head is saying, "You know, I'm going to kill every one of you."
Because that's roughly the number of nuclear weapons that Israel has available to use on Iran, where Iran has no means of defending itself. But let's go on. Hey, Nick, welcome to the program.
Bob, what's happening, man?
Just sitting here trying to keep my eyeballs in my skull.
Oh God, me too, man. Oh, I'm infuriated. Oh my God, keeping it with the same vein in the talk about Rockefeller. Oh my God. You know, friendly listener, I am from West Virginia, and Rockefeller,
I'm guessing he can't count on your vote in November, Nick.
Oh, hell no, man. God, I can't believe it, dude. I can't believe it.
It almost drives you speechless, doesn't it?
It really does. Were you able to see an image of him at the podium?
No, I'm flying blind here. I'm strictly on instrument flight rules.
Bob. You would have blown it, man. Rockefeller, West Virginia, right? They got pictures of mountains behind him.
Oh, I heard him mention the mighty mountains, and that's when I said, oh, you got a lot of nerve.
So much nerve. So much nerve to get up there on stage, have the mountains behind him, and say, tomorrow's clean coal. We'll talk about clean coal. When the people of southern West Virginia are down here fighting for their lives from disease and poisoned water and mountaintop removal and everything that he knows is going on in West Virginia right now that none of them will do anything about, he's up there toting it as some kind of answer. But I'm guessing
those pictures of those mighty mountains were some of those Pocahontas County mountains around, you know, his little enclave. There wasn't no picture of Kayford Mountain up there, was there, Nick?
Wasn't any pictures of mountains in southern West Virginia, because they're hard to find around here. You know, even the communities, you know, pushing the coal industry coming in, pushing the people out of the communities, man.
But I loved what Mark, and Mark, you can verify this, not a peep out of the audience when he said clean coal.
Yeah, not a peep. Tomorrow, clean coal.
Quiet. We've had some lousy speakers. I think the audience was really quiet. In fact, he had to mention Obama about three times until finally there was some a little bit of cheers from the audience. And they weren't cheering for Rockefeller. They were cheering for Obama.
But they were sitting on their hands when he was talking clean coal.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of people have figured it out. I think our message is really beginning to get out, Nick. Even though the Fockers have their billboards up all over Denver.
They do, man. I need to send you some images of that, Bob. I don't know if you got pictures of them. I got plenty of pictures of these billboards that say, yes, coal. Clean, carbon neutral coal.
Yeah, we've got one of those that pops up in the chat room from time to time. I bet by the time this is heard, it'll come up in the chat room. And they had billboards. They had a billboard at one of the entrances to the Pepsi Center that's the Democratic National Convention, brought to you by Clean Coal.
Oh God, Bo Webb. You know Bo Webb, Bob?
Oh gosh, yeah, love Bo to death.
Bo Webb actually started a petition to try to get those down as false advertising, misleading the public. It's complete propaganda.
Well, and the question is, who believes it? I mean, Mark, I know you got to love this. Is it up in the chat room yet? Have you seen this? It's a photograph of the billboard.
Yeah,
there it is.
Carbon neutral coal. I thought coal was made of carbon. But
well, it is. That's like saying bullet neutral bullets.
Yeah,
I see. So,
or fat, fat free fat.
Yeah.
Well, they had that in an episode of Seinfeld, so it must be true. They had fat-free fat. It was in, I think, their muffins or their yogurt.
Yeah, was that the same episode that had the man's ear?
I think that was it.
Oh, God, we're afield now.
They're talking renewable energy at the Democratic National Convention, okay? And we're down here working on a wind farm in southern West Virginia in the heart of coal country, right?
Yeah.
Taboo, right? But we're working on what would be the largest wind farm on the East Coast that will prevent an entire mountain range from being destroyed by mountaintop removal, and these guys are not talking about it. They're talking about clean coal. They're not talking about investing in renewable energies in West Virginia because they plan to destroy it all and ship it out of our state and most of it out of our nation to fund other people.
And that's the question they can't answer. And it's the same thing, Mark, that applies to offshore drilling, too. If this is gonna lower our gas prices. Look, the people mining the coal and the people pumping out the oil, regardless of where it's coming from, because it's a free market. Yeehaw! They have the right to say where it gets sold, right, Mark?
Yeah.
So the oil pumped out of the continental shelf, that's going on the open market. It's not going to American refineries or American gas stations. And by the same token, 50% of the coal that comes out of America, Appalachia, Powder River Basin, what have you, it all goes to China. And by the way, some mountaintop removal coal goes to Israel, Mark.
Okay. I don't know how you expect me to respond to that.
But, well, no, I mean, nobody, everybody's like, what? Yeah, it does. Found that out recently.
It goes to many nations.
There's a move afoot to try to get the Israelis to eliminate the use of mountaintop removal coal. But most of the exported coal, of course, goes to China. And then it floats back, its filth floats back across the Pacific and lands on the Pacific coast. Lovely how that works, isn't it? Nick, we still got you?
Yeah, we got you, man. Tell you what, can I throw Lorella on real quick?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, one sec.
Lorella's a firecracker. You're going to love her, Mark.
Okay, just so you know, after Patrick Murphy is Madeleine Albright. We can hear her if you want. After that, there's a discussion on the economy with Congressman Joe Sestak. You may remember him.
You schooled him a little bit.
He came on my show, and I taught him a little bit about inherent contempt, and he really wasn't happy to hear it.
Although it happened again. I don't know if you caught it or not, but there was another federal court decision saying that the Bush White House had to honor the congressional subpoenas.
Not only did I catch it, but I have to tell you, John Conyers, who I talked to about it, didn't think this judge was going to go his way because he was appointed by George W. Bush. And you know what the judge said? They said to the lawyer representing Congress, well, why not just use inherent contempt and put them in jail? And I about, you know, rolled out of my seat. I mean, this is a Bush judge actually upholding the Constitution. You know, I guess, you know, it can happen. There are honest people. Here, the Democrats were so afraid of using their power, and the judge said, well, hey, go right ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Lorella, are you there, Lorella?
Do we have her?
Lorella, are you there?
I don't hear you.
I'm on.
Oh, there you are. Okay, gotcha. Go ahead, Lorella. Yeah, hey, how are you?
Well, I was okay until Jay Rockefeller got on.
Sorry to make everyone depressed. I mean, most of these people are pretty good.
But no, we needed this, Mark. Lorella, don't you agree? People have to hear what a sleazy little whore he is.
Well, yes, I guess they do. And I think Nick said earlier, we in the southern coal fields of West Virginia are proposing the biggest wind farm on the East Coast. And for your information, Senator Jay Rockefeller's office has refused to even see a professional presentation on that wind farm project.
Won't even look at it.
Even see a presentation.
We have attempted to do a presentation to Senator Byrd's office and Senator Rockefeller's office and Congressman Ray Hall's office, and Byrd's office has not even responded to our request, and that was submitted about 5 or 6 weeks ago. Rockefeller's office finally did give us a call back, and his representative said they are not interested in a presentation at this time, and he assured me that they had heard about the project. And Ray Hall's office, my buddy Nikki Joe, has tentatively agreed to maybe a meeting at the end of September, tentatively.
I reckon he'll scream at you again, Lorella?
Well...
Hold on. Mark.
Yes.
Fade the feed, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's off. Actually, the feed is off. This is coming through my mic. It's that loud in the room.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Lorella, please.
It's very loud in here. I apologize.
He pulled his little screaming stuff. We see that we had a video camera running, so he was a lot more civilized. And we are planning to tentatively meet at his office in Beckley, not in D.C. this time. And my suspicion is that something's going to come up before now and the date of the tentative meeting that, you know, he will find a way not to meet with us.
Classy guy.
What's happening here is our representatives, our lawmakers, the people who have the power to change what's going on.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Bob. Do you want to hear Mountain Albright, or should we skip
Not particularly. Let's stay with Lorella.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Lorella.
Are refusing to even take part in this at all. We met with the governor's office and met with Jim Petrillo with the governor's office, and he at least sat through a presentation, through a PowerPoint presentation, listened to what we had to say, asked a few questions, and said that he would pass the information on to the governor, and we've had no follow-up from that either. So these people have the power to stop what's going on here, and because they keep touting clean coal, they're not doing anything at all to change what's going on down here.
Well, our buddy, you know J.W. Randolph, right?
Yes, I do.
J.W. had a blog post about the Coal River Wind Project up at Alternet today. And yay me, I was the first to post a response to it. But, you know, the word is getting out. And like I said to Nick, there wasn't a blessed soul cheering when Rockefeller said clean coal. We're going to win this fight, Lorella.
I believe we are. And I think it takes extreme ignorance to stand in a building with that many people who I am absolutely certain that the majority of them would be environmentally conscious. That you know, that most of them are at least aware of what's going on in the world, and they are aware of the fact that burning fossil fuels is contributing to a lot of the problems that we have. I know one speaker stepped up earlier and said that his grandson was 6 months old, and if he lived to be 92, that he would be around the turn of the next century, and he was concerned about what type of world we would be leaving for him. And my comment to that was, that's exactly what we all should be thinking.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Be stopping and thinking about what kind of world we are going to leave those little ones that will be left behind. I have a 4-year-old granddaughter, and I shudder to think of what kind of world she's going to have when she's an adult. And we all should develop that type of mentality. And if we can do that, then we will not have any desire at all to burn another lump of coal, whether they classify it clean or not. I was on Decision Makers over the weekend, and Bray Carey, you know, kept trying to pin me down as to whether or not I was for clean coal. And finally, my comment was, of course I am, if there is such a thing.
Right, because, frankly, there isn't. There can't be. You know, the only way you can get away with using the phrase clean coal is if you're willing to pretend that Cayford Mountain doesn't exist.
Yeah.
If you're willing to pretend that the 2.8 billion gallons of carcinogenic, toxic to the touch goo that hangs over the head of the children at Marsh Fork Elementary doesn't exist.
Correct.
Because no matter what you do to the coal after it's out of the ground, how you get it out of the ground is dirty by definition. So there's really no way around it. Lorella, one of the things I found interesting was, did you watch the coverage last night or hear the coverage last night?
I saw Hillary's speech.
Did you catch, you didn't catch Brian Schweitzer?
I did not.
Okay, he's the governor of Montana, and of course, he's the guy from whom Joe Manchin got the cold liquids idea.
Really?
Yeah, because the Powder River Basin is, of course, in Montana, and that's destroyed the watershed for God knows thousands of square.
The river used to run through it, right?
Right, exactly. Well, oddly enough, he did a passing mention of coal gasification, but he spent all of his time talking about renewables, solar and wind, and he came up with the greatest line of the convention thus far, and that is, no petro dictator can ever own American sunshine and wind. And that's that, you know, that I think that's a message we got to get behind that message.
That's absolutely true. And I think when I called in last week, you know, that's why I said that they have refused to allow renewables into this state so far because they don't own it. They don't own the sun and the wind, and they have to wait until they can find a way for them to profit off it before they would develop it. That's why T. Boone Pickens is no longer an oil man, and he's decided to go for wind, because oil is not a hot commodity now. We're moving away from it, and we're moving to renewables. Big money is in renewables now, not oil anymore.
And he's smart enough to figure out that that's the next place for him to find his next billion. Absolutely.
Right.
And
well, actually, let me interject here. You know, he's got the new commercial that, you know, does say that he's completely for drilling, but we need to do wind too. I'm telling you, I really speculate T. Boone, you know, investing in wind to stable the foundation, then, you know, keep drilling. I think T. Boone's going to be all for everything, man. He's using, throwing around the phrase alternative fuels, which he's talking about gas for cars and things, but I think he's going to work his way around to clean coal too, because he does have a commercial that touts more drilling in addition to the wind.
Oh, I don't doubt it in the least, Nick. And I wanted to tell both of you, and Mark, we're not just ignoring you. I wanted to tell both of you, I just now, even
that's
as...
okay, I've just announced Evan Bison. If you want to hear him, I can, or we'll just keep...
You can't afford to have me fall asleep and have my head hit the microphone. I might get hurt, Mark.
All right, we'll cut off Evan Bison. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I wanted to let you both know, this literally just came in while we were talking. You remember we had this blessing of the mountain here where I live back in April. It was on the anniversary of it was on the weekend of the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King.
It was April 5th.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be doing it again. Just got the notification. Blessing of the Mountain 3 will take place on Sunday, October the 5th at 3 p.m.
Right.
At the same location. So let folks know down there because... we need, you know, I'm sure the coal thugs will come up and try to intimidate us again.
I have to say that that's probably one of the most shameful things that they do. I wasn't able to attend that Blessing of the Mountains because we were on our way to D.C. for a lobby week, but I know people who were there. And my question is, what kind of people stand in the way of a prayer vigil?
It wasn't just a prayer vigil. It was an official Episcopal Mass.
Yeah.
Yeah. What type of people keep people from praying? I don't get it.
Well, you know, if that's the thing with a slave. If the coal company tells you that's what you're going to do, that's what you're going to do.
It's disgusting. Let me just interject real quick, man. I just want to say that, you know, one of the reasons I called in tonight was, I wanted to just put out there for people that, our most abundant resource in this country is not coal. It's not. It is the sun and the wind. The solution rises every day. It's blown in the wind. Coal is a finite resource. It won't be here forever. The wind will be blowing long after each and every single one of us are gone. We need to invest in those so we don't have to destroy some of the most biodiverse temperate forest in the entire world, destroy majestic mountains that are just as much a national treasure as they are a world treasure. It's an American treasure. The Appalachian Mountain Range is something that none of us in America can afford to let stand by and let be destroyed.
One of the last great temperate rainforests left on the planet, bar none. Well, Lorella, Nick, I really appreciate you calling in, and just as an aside, I'm looking forward to the weekend. I don't know what we're going to do if it pours down.
We'll stand on the porch if it pours down.
That's right. I'll bring the mandolin. I'm really bad, but there may be somebody there that can play it.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
Hey, Nick, Lorella, thanks so much. I'll take care.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye now. That's Nick and Lorella from Coal River Mountain Watch, two of the most dedicated people that I know, and everything they said is 100% correct. Let's go. Let's keep rolling. Hey, Ben.
Hey there.
What's happening?
Not a whole lot. Just a couple things I think I need to comment on. First, let's understand something really important about coal. Coal is extraordinarily valuable to our future. We have to keep all that coal that we've got in the ground and find ways to extract it that are clean and don't involve danger to human beings. And the reason we have to do that is because there are certain chemical processes that we depend on. We could not produce medicines without, we could not produce plastics without, that absolutely depend on coal.
Well, the thing that comes most
ground is too valuable to burn.
That much is true, and except with one exception, Ben, the thing that comes to mind for me, and I acknowledge this, is metallurgical coal.
Oh. Yeah,
you've got to have metallurgical quality coal in order to make things like molybdenum steel.
You can't make steel without coal. We've never found a way to do it. And people have looked. The Third Reich looked for a way to make steel without coal. They couldn't do it.
Exactly. Right?
They looked real hard.
And the thing is, I remember once you brought up the concept of robotic mining for very small seams of coal.
Oh, yeah, I really absolutely believe that it is entirely within our capability to design something that can actually mine out a seam that is 6 inches deep, take only the coal, leaving almost no overburden to make a tailing heap out of, and then let the mountain collapse behind it as it goes so that the mountain falls about 6 inches rather than having the whole top of the damn thing torn off.
Yeah, and when we're talking about tops, we're talking about 800 feet.
Yeah, there's no reason to remove the entire top of a mountain. You can design a robot to do that job. I am absolutely certain.
And even the other thing, Ben, is that the only reason these people are doing it this way, they talk about, coal brings jobs to Appalachia. You know, there's 5,000 mountaintop removers in this state now.
Yeah, dynamite is really, really, really cheap.
Yeah, and those guys don't know anything about mining. All they're doing, they're just demolition operators.
Yeah, they are. Dynamite is very, very, very cheap. It is much cheaper than human labor. It is certainly much, they think it's much cheaper than the machinery I'm talking about, but it's really not.
No, because there's no workers' comp involved. There's no FICA involved. Right.
They think it's cheaper than the machinery because they're not paying the entire cost. They were given a pass by the Bush administration to not return the land to its original land form. And because they were given that pass, they don't actually pay the entire cost of what they're doing. They're not paying for the cleanup, they're not paying for the restoration, they're not paying for any of that. And that is a cost that is taken out of the commons, that is taken out of our pockets and our heritage, that is given to the coal barons. If the coal barons had to actually pay the cost of what they are doing, then it wouldn't be cheap to remove the tops of mountains, and it would be very cheap for them to spend the few billion it will take to develop the robotic machinery that could day in, day out, be pumping coal out of a little hole in the side of the mountain and sending it down a conveyor to the tipple.
And, of course, one of the other thing that comes out of all this is and they have no intention of figuring out what to do about it, the sludge lake's been.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this stuff is literally black mud, probably 99% of which is pure carcinogen.
And if you do robotic mining, because seam mining does not produce sludge like that.
That's my point.
And you do seam mining, and you can mine seams that would never be safe for a human being to go into because they're too gassy or a lot of other reasons. You don't have to provide, with robots, you don't have to provide blowers, you don't have to provide any of that stuff. All you have to do is design the equipment, and the equipment goes in, makes its own little gallery, goes in along that gallery, and starts mining out the seam. And that equipment leaves less coal in the ground than it can because that equipment can do retreat mining.
And if the stuff is reserved, I mean, it's being thrown away. I mean, I'm not anti-China or anything, but for heaven's sakes, they keep touting how, oh, this is our energy independence. Horse feathers, if it's our energy independence, why is 50% of it in China?
Exactly right. Well, I think, first of all, we should make it illegal to export American coal and oil under any circumstances for any use. Because we are net importers of oil to begin with, and, you know, these people have, a lot of countries are just not digging their own coal, they're taking ours, because we produce ours so cheaply. Okay? And we should just keep it here, and we should find ways to extract it that are clean and safe. Safe for the miners, safe for the people who live around the mines, and doable. And then find ways to stop burning the stuff because, you know, in 10,000 years, we're still going to need iron. In 10,000 years, we are still going to need to make plastics and medicines and a lot of other things that you can only make with coal. The feedstock that coal provides is just not easily replaceable. You could
and the thing is, when you're talking about medicines and things like that, the chemical processes, you're not talking about you're not talking about the vast quantity that is required for power generation.
Oh, God, no.
It reminds me a little bit of the silicon situation. I've mentioned on the program in the past, my father was a silicon furnace operator.
Yes.
And he took quartz rock and coke and wood chips and a whole bunch of electricity and melted the quartz rocks. The oxygen combusted and silicon metal poured out. They alloyed that with aluminum to create engine blocks, basically, and heads that could withstand high heat and high heat temperatures that an engine generates, and not warp because aluminum unalloyed will warp. But that being the case, look at what the next and single most useful of silicon turned out to be.
Exactly right.
It's inside every computer of everybody listening to this program.
And if you took all of the silicon and all of the chips that we use in the United States in a year, it wouldn't be a train load.
Right. Right.
Okay?
Exactly.
We're talking huge quantities. The other thing I have to say, and this is partially directed at Mark, if Mark's still there.
I am still here. I just admit that this is not a subject that I know about near as much as Bob, and when I don't know as much about it as somebody else, I let them speak.
But well, that's
ahead.
The beauty. You're getting an education, Mark.
I am.
But the other thing is, I think, you know, and you know I'm a Zionist. You know, Israel has to exist and has a right to exist and ought to exist. They are doing an extraordinarily bad job in managing perception, and what they are doing that is really bad in managing perception is when they create delivery systems that have a throw that is as far away as China. Okay? There is no conceivable threat to Israel that I can imagine that would not be backed up by the United States and by most of Europe that would require them to have a throw capability for a megaton warhead that's that far away. And I think if Israel wanted to manage its perception, it would destroy those delivery systems and break up its aerial refueling tankers. And then nobody would ever believe that Israel was planning to use nuclear weapons for anything except border defense.
Ben, Israel has said that it will not be the first nation to introduce nuclear weapons in the region. But
nobody wants to.
I'll tell you this. Oh, yes, they do. Hamas has said that. I mean, Iran has said. They've all said they want to wipe Israel off the map. Hamas has said the leader, Nasrallah, has said he wants to kill every Jew in the world.
Not just Israel, but he doesn't have the capability, and he's in Gaza.
No, he doesn't right now. Here's the thing. Israel's first concern is not perception. Israel's first concern is survival. This is a country that, obviously, after 6 million were killed, Israel would have 9 million people today. They could have the West Bank and Gaza and have a clear majority of Jews, but they don't, because what happened? The United States and Europe and Asia and every single country on earth said, let the Jews die. They're not that important. And that, you got to understand, this is a visceral feeling of every Israeli, from the far left to the far right. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Right now, Pakistan is a democracy, but Pakistan, we know, can go in all kinds of directions. And I think the reason Israel has that capability is that if an Osama bin Laden or something like that were to take over Pakistan, they would want to be able to attack back. That's why it exists. But, I think it can only be used for defensive. And if you think about it, Israel is constantly surrounded by people saying that it shouldn't exist. If people would accept Israel to be in the region, they wouldn't need to have these kinds of weapons.
I think there's a perception management issue here. I think Israel could sell itself. I think Israel could convince every one of its neighbors that it was peaceful, was no threat to them, and ought to be allowed to exist if it managed the situation right. And right now what we have is just an adversarial situation, and it's not managed right. It's very much like the Cold War.
Ben, they didn't have nuclear weapons in 1948 when they were attacked, 1947. They didn't have it in 56 when they were attacked. They didn't have it in 67. Maybe they did have it by 67.
They did have it.
The first one was 64.
64,
I think you're right. But they were attacked in 67. And each time Israel has said, just accept that we exist. We can argue about where the borders lie. Stop trying to murder every one of us. And everyone has said, no, we want to murder every one of you. There's always been someone on earth, and a very powerful country saying so. So, I don't blame them. And as far as perception, I guess the way Israel sees this, we'd rather live than die. And in our view, perception is not as important as reality. Israel, you have to understand, Israel firmly believes that if it is attacked, not only will the United States not come to its aid, no one will. I mean, if any country does, it might be the United States, but I guarantee you the great majority of Israelis feel like if Israel's attacked, if Israel's nuked, and it only takes one bomb because it's the size of New Jersey. If Israel's nuked, I think the great majority of Israelis feel, and they may be right, that Americans wouldn't want to risk nuclear war by responding. And so they would just say,
honest to God, Mark.
Die.
Who would nuke Israel? Because you nuke,
Iran.
No, because how many Arabs do you kill doing that?
You nuke Jordan if you nuke Israel.
Well, no, Jordan gets along with Israel.
So they're
actually
so stupid. Let me get this straight. The Persians are so stupid that they just don't care.
No. Please understand, Bob. First of all, Persians, as you know, are not Arabs. Second of all, they're Shia. The Palestinians are Sunni. Here's one thing I guarantee you. The Iranian government does not give a damn about a single Palestinian Arab. I assure you. In fact,
that's why they won't even do this. They're not interested in doing this. What they are interested in doing and what all the bluster is about is not intentioned to actually threaten Israel. It is intentioned to give them some leverage with the Arabs who actually hate all of the Persians.
there's a great element of truth because, Mark, you got to admit, if Iran wanted to kill all the Jews, they'd start with all the Jews that live in Iran in peace.
That's true. That is true. Look, here's what generally happens with dictators, whether it be the government of Iran or the government of Syria or the government of Egypt or, frankly, Saddam Hussein when he was around. Is dictators need a foreign enemy. Heck, we can throw in Stalin in the mix. Dictators need a foreign enemy in order to keep their position of power because they don't want their public to focus on the horrible things they're doing, and so they want them to focus on a foreign enemy. And there's no question that that is what the Iranian government is doing. But at the same time, Israel fears some renegade in some country, and, you know, there's some 22 countries at war with Israel, will take a weapon. And they want the nuclear weapon as a deterrent.
And let's see, what's the greater likelihood, Mark, that the country that doesn't have a nuclear weapon is going to get all renegade, or the crazier than a sprayed roach country full of fundamentalists that has a nuclear arsenal, Pakistan, might get sideways? You know, that's why I don't understand all the saber-rattling about Iran. But it's a little inconvenient because, you know, we're buddies with Pakistan. So we can't saber-rattle at them so much.
Seriously, if there was going to be a threat, it already exists. If Israel nuked any Muslim nation, Pakistan would respond. Pakistan absolutely would respond. Because Pakistan has a lot to gain by responding in esteem in the rest of the Muslim world that it does not now have. Okay, and but the issue here is if somebody takes a bomb and smuggles it into Tel Aviv and sets it off. Now, clearly, they're not going to nuke Jerusalem for obvious reasons. Who do you bomb? Where do you send the nuclear weapon that you're able to throw all the way to China? Because you have to actually know, really and truly, who to take out for that. Sure, yeah, okay, the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine, you know, claims responsibility. Where are they? They're all over. They're in Jordan, they're in Lebanon, they're in the United States, they're in Germany, they're in Italy. The people who are members of that group are such a diffuse element that knowing where to send the nuclear weapon is essentially impossible. And therefore, it provides no real deterrent. And that's my issue. I think Israel is less safe having nuclear weapons than Israel would be if it simply had an extraordinarily strong conventional force able to smash anything there.
And that's applicable across the board. Poland is less safe, Ben, having agreed to put our stupid little ABM system in.
Oh, they are. They become a target. Poland isn't a target until then.
Right.
Well, is Iran stupid then for trying to insist that it needs nuclear energy when it's got the third largest oil reserves in the world?
Actually, no. I think everyone needs nuclear. Everyone needs nuclear energy. All nations require nuclear energy because the oil is going to be gone very soon. And I think that the one thing we do know about a nuclear deterrent is that having a large number of weapons is not required. Even a small number of deterrents or three in a manner of weapons. Anyway, that's all I had to say, guys.
Okay, thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Ben. We'll have to have a conversation a longer time on this. I apologize. Actually, Stephanie Miller sitting next to me, and she kicked the plug out of my Ethernet cord.
Tell Stephanie that Denverge told her that was bad, bad, bad.
Well, I did. I tried, but, you know, no, she certainly didn't do it on purpose. But I'll tell you, what's coming up next now is the music prior to Bill Clinton. He is the next guest.
Thanks, Ben. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Ben. So now they're doing a song, Che Che Change. I'll just play a tiny bit of feed from the hall. So
obviously the song is Change.
The song is Chain of Fools.
Oh, Chain, oh, it is?
Yes.
I showed you what I know. Is that what it, well, that's a strange song then, isn't it?
Not really,
right,
if you're talking about the, not if you're talking about the Bush administration.
Okay, well, I missed what they said before this. Before this was Tom Daschle. Maybe that's what he said. I was listening to Ben and trying to preserve my connection here. So, it's Chain of Fools. See, now I'm not good at listening to
and
this
so
song.
Stephanie Miller's sitting next to you?
She is. Now there's a guy in between. But she kicked out my Ethernet cord.
it was deliberate. It was deliberate. To get her to come over and say hello. But
should I invite her on the show?
Oh, sure. Why not? Nope.
Okay, I don't know. Bill Clinton's about to come up.
Is Bill on his way?
We don't see him. All we hear is music and people waving flags. But I feel like it could happen any moment. I tell you this though, Bill is really good at time, and I truly doubt he'll be there before the top of the hour, which is when he's promoted.
Yeah, and
so
I tell you what, let's take this. We've got 54 seconds. Let's take this moment and let me just transition to the next segment. Okay, stand by, please, Mark.
Perfect timing.
So that's the end of this segment of tonight's programming. Of course, all of the convention coverage, like all the programming on the Horn, is brought to you by our dear friends, the bravest, most hardworking folks I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Go to coalriverwind.org. Sign the petition if you haven't already. If you've already signed the petition, for heaven's sakes, please encourage your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, even people that you don't know on the street, to go and do so. We're getting real weight behind this petition, and it's going to be hard to ignore when there are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of names on it. So thanks a lot. We'll go dark for just a second, and then we will start up the next segment.